issue that we are dealing with
is a very serious issue that we are dealing with. Add to it that this problem must be addressed, because prison was never built to keep children in prison. I know that all the political parties in parliament are very serious in addressing this problem of children in prison. We are sitting here today because we as the portfolio committee are the fighters for children not to be put in prison. And we are serious to see to it that this goal must be realized. We have invited the Department of Correctional Services, the Department of Social Welfare, the Department of Justice, and the Legal Aid Board lawyers, and Sasha Gear. So, to have an insight on what is the problem, why are we still having children in prison? As I have said, it's not a place for children. And when I'm saying children, it's 18 downwards, from 17. Downwards. We don't want to. And when we visit prisons, unfortunately, we see these children in our prisons. All of you know about the unfortunate and unacceptable incident in the Durban Westville prison, where this child was allegedly put amongst a 14-year-old boy or 15-year-old boy. Was put in a cell with adults. In the first place, this child was not supposed to be, without any argument or what is it true that this child was put into that cell or not? This child was not supposed to be. You see, we are putting very serious strain and blame on the Department of Correctional Services. But in fact, they are not supposed to have children in the prisons. But they are saying, what can they do, because the courts are sending these children to prison with a warrant, and they can't refuse to have these children there in prison. But we, as the portfolio committee, are saying, no, there's secure care facilities, there's reformatory schools, the departments are here today, so that we must hear from the departments, what is the problem? Why are we still having children in prison? We will have figures, how many children are still in prison. I see that the Department of Correctional Service have given us a very good presentation here, a document. I hope that all the members and our guests must have copies of this presentation from the Department of Correctional Services. I hope that you also have the program for today's meeting. If you don't have, can you indicate so that we must give you a copy of the program? Can we have copies? This side as well, yeah? Mr. Self, do you have a copy? Okay.
So what?
We have planned that the Center for Study of Violence and Reconciliation must start first. After that, we will have correctional services, followed by the Department of Justice, but the Department of Justice have asked us to swap because they must go to another meeting. I will address that now, and then Department of Social Welfare, Social Development. And then after that, it's questions for clarification, and yeah. And after, then we have a tea break, and after that, the Legal Aid Board lawyers will brief us. The purpose of our meeting is really for us as the Portfolio Committee to have the main stakeholders in one room. It is not and come up with a solution. You see, the last point on our agenda, 12 o'clock, way forward and stakeholders' recommendations. All of us must get a solution, must find a solution to this problem. It is not a thing of the Portfolio Committee or the Department of Correctional Services, of Social Welfare and what. All of us, must get the solution and find the solution to this problem. We will start with Center for Sasha Gay will start, and then we will swap justice. But justice must come back. Justice must come back after their presentation. They can go to that meeting, but come back because there will be questions, especially from myself. To justice. I don't know the other members, but I am having serious questions on justice. And then the Department of Correctional Services will present after justice then. Is that fine with you, Commissioner? That's all right. Okay. No, that's okay. You will stay here now, ne? You will stay here. Yeah, that's good. Because you people are creating a lot of problems. And I was surprised that you are all of a sudden having another meeting. No, that's fine. But you will stay here. So that will be our program. And I will really plead with presenters to stick to the time. We have given presenters 20 minutes to present, but I've learned that Shasha is only needing 5 minutes. That's okay. But I know that you are talking a lot and you are having a lot to say, but that's fine. Go straight into your presentation. Thank you very much.
This button. Okay. Thank you very much and for the opportunity to participate today. Morning to everybody. I'm Sasha Gere from the Centre for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation. And on the basis of some of our experiences at the CSVR, I'm going to focus on conditions in the Department of Correctional Services correctional centers, which hold male youth and children. Children held by the DCS are housed in centers catering for youth up to and including 21 years of age. Although children younger than 18 are held in different cells and in some centers in different sections. However, as the Judicial Inspectorate pointed out in their latest annual report, these young people often come into daily contact with adult prisoners and are mostly transported to and from court with adult prisoners. CSVR recently conducted a survey in one Gauteng correctional center for male youth and this provided several findings in relation to the incarceration of children in that facility. And just to emphasize that I'm talking about findings related to that facility, although some of the issues may well be shared in others. And this was a relatively small, medium security center. And at the time we conducted the research, it had a population of between 462 and 438 inmates, which meant that it was one of the few places that was not operating in overcrowded conditions. A breakdown of the ages of our respondents, and the respondents were drawn from a representative sample, pointed to two problems. Firstly, the number of children who were being held in the institution, and secondly, a substantial proportion of inmates were 22 years or older and therefore should not have been held in the youth facility at all. 9% were children younger than 18, and 13% were 22 or older. Although the youth center should not have been housing anyone over the age of 21, just more than 1 in 10 were therefore over 22 years. This high proportion of those over 21 came as a surprise to center management and the senior staff when we presented them with the findings. Both respondents and staff members, however, pointed out that it is not uncommon for an offender to lie about his age, to say that he is younger than he actually is, in the hopes of a more lenient sentence, bail, or so as not to land in an adult prison. If there is no proof to the contrary, then the institution has no choice but to house that inmate. This situation means that other inmates in the center, including children, may be at additional risk of abuse and exploitation. In this particular center where we conduct the research, children aged under 18 are housed in communal cells in a section that is separate to the other inmates. They do, however, mix with other inmates to attend school, church, or if they're involved in sporting activities. And all of them are supposed to be attending school, but if they refuse to do so, then they're kept during the morning in their separate section while the others are at the classrooms. The center administration complained that even when a magistrate stipulates that the young offender should not be placed in prison, but should rather be sent to an industrial school or one of the other facilities under the Department of Education or Social Development, they are anyway being sent to correctional centers on the grounds that there are no available spaces in the industrial schools. The correctional centers, the staff there, said they are assured that they will be contacted as soon as place becomes available. But often the child has served most of the sentence by the time this happens, and therefore only serves the very last bit, often as little as a month or so, at the appropriate facility. At the Gauteng Youth Centre, where we conducted the survey, the head of the prison also told us that they'd applied for funding to build and support certain cells to cater for juveniles who were awaiting trial, but that the funding had never come through. Youth, including children, are therefore held in the awaiting trial section of the adult prison, where children are separated from other inmates. Beyond the case of this particular centre, there are many children incarcerated in correctional centres who should be in other institutions instead, and preferably not in institutions at all. But the majority of those held in correctional centres are unsentenced children who are being kept in the awaiting trial sections of our correctional centres. Because DCS has its emphasis on programs and services for sentenced prisoners, it also does not pay adequate attention to the needs and the development of the unsentenced children. And while the Correctional Services Act specifies that both sentenced and unsentenced children must receive education, social services, religious care, and recreational programs, indications are that children in awaiting trial sections are rarely receiving these services and opportunities. In our survey, in the Gauteng Centre, we also sought to measure the previous exposure of the respondents to institutions, both safe care facilities and those facilities for young children in trouble with the law. We were interested in this because of the impact of that exposure, the exposure to those sorts of institutions, the impact that that has on young people's development. And fundamentally, we found that although 80% of the respondents had no prior conviction, 68%, two-thirds of them, had previously spent time in a prison, police cell, or another type of secure facility. And this was separate to the current sentence they were serving and its awaiting trial period. This finding points to high levels of exposure to institutions and the criminal justice system amongst our young people, even when this does not necessarily culminate in conviction. And although the findings related to the youth in general, it included those under 18. At the same time, a proportion of even those over 18 would have been children at the time of their previous exposure to the criminal justice system. Also, in relation to the survey, while children's exposure to violence in the centre does not appear to be greater than that of the other youth in the centre, the young people's levels of fear and exposure to violence was generally high. The youth were more likely to feel unsafe or very unsafe than they were to feel safe. 27% admitted to assaulting or hurting another inmate while in that correctional centre, and 29% said that they had been attacked, assaulted, or physically hurt while being in that specific centre. 17% of the youth who'd been in the centre for less than 1 month had already experienced assault. Turning to findings on sexual violence specifically, 17 of the respondents, which amounted to 6% of the sample, said that they had tricked, manipulated, or threatened another inmate into having sex. And this is one of the forms of violence to which young inmates and children are particularly vulnerable. They are at increased risk because of two main features. Children are often first-time offenders, and this puts them in danger in a range of respects. Trickery and manipulation are often used by other inmates to perpetrate sexual violence by, for example, offering to care for or protect newcomers, offering them food, cigarettes, or drugs. Then, the person who's done the offering will claim that the new offender owes them sex in return for what they've been given. And if he refuses, he'll usually be raped. The young newcomer is vulnerable because of not being familiar with the inmate culture. He is less likely to be suspicious of the apparent gestures of kindness when offered things by others, and is also afraid of the overwhelming situation he's confronted with when he first finds himself behind bars. The overwhelming and frequently terrifying situation which first-time inmates face on arrival also sees many of them being intimidated into joining gangs, which in turn may place them at additional risk. At the same time, children and other young inmates are in heightened danger of being targets of rape because of their usually youthful physical appearance. Those who look young are regarded as especially desirable by those other inmates seeking out people to take as their sex slaves or take as their vafis, as they're known. And although children are being held in separate cells and are hopefully most of the time also being held in separate sections to other offenders, there are times when they mix. Particularly disturbing, we also know that some corrupt officials are involved in selling children and other young and vulnerable inmates to other inmates for the purposes of sex. And ongoing reports tell us that this practice persists. In addition, and speaking more generally, even when children are being effectively separated from other inmates, amongst the children themselves, there will always be certain ones who bully and hurt others. There are also a range of factors in correctional centres that encourage people to perpetrate violence. For example, inmates may seek to develop an aggressive reputation as a way of protecting themselves from falling victim to others, or to prevent being labelled as a suitable target for sexual violence. And there's also the likelihood in correctional centres that inmates may already be aggressive or have other social problems. In our study, the proportion of inmates who reported having been forced into sex by other inmates was similar to the proportion of women and girls in broader society who are estimated to be raped every year. And an important aspect of this finding, however, was that most of the incarcerated interviewees had spent less than a year at the centre when they were interviewed. And furthermore, the centre, as I mentioned earlier, was a relatively small, juvenile, medium security facility which was not overcrowded at the time. The survey also highlighted severe shortcomings with measures to address assault. Over half of the most recent assaults had not been reported to officials. And here I'm talking about assaults generally, not only the sexual violence cases, which are particularly, you find a lack of reporting, particularly in respect of sexual violence, but this was generally. And almost one in four respondents who had not reported said that they did not report because they didn't think it would make any difference. 20% said they'd been afraid to report, or of being further victimized if they did report. The survey respondents were also more pessimistic when asked about staff responses to sexual assault compared to how they appraised staff response to other forms of assault. And as they'd been in the institution for longer and presumably therefore had greater insights into how things worked there, they became increasingly pessimistic. In conclusion, it is promising that the numbers of children in prison have reduced in recent years, and government must continue and intensify its efforts to remove children from prisons, especially those awaiting trial. In the meantime, the DCS must look closely at its youth policy and assess the extent to which its desired objectives are being implemented across the country. And then it needs to urgently take steps to address these where these objectives are not being achieved. In particular, we hope it can put in place measures to promote the safe custody of children where they are being detained. And this is vitally important to minimize the damaging effects that prison experiences are having on our young people's development. Thank you very much.
Sasha, why are you not going to the recommendation?
Because I thought I had read
Our
recommendations, the primary recommendation is that children should be kept out of prison. But we have some recommendations regarding when they are detained. The first and most basic one being that they should at all times be separated from juvenile and adult inmates. but also that before, within sections for children, before being allocated to share cells with certain other children, they need to be very carefully assessed and selected, and other aspects of vulnerability need to be considered. There also should be ongoing monitoring of and discussions with children, so that correctional staff are able to pick up problems in a proactive way, and to pick up on warning signs. For example, if people are showing behaviors such as depression, anxiety, and fear. And we hope, therefore, that a lot of the damage can be prevented before it's realized. Children encountering problems must be immediately referred to professional staff for assistance. And this speaks more generally, I think, of a problem we see in our correctional centers, whereby access that inmates have to professional staff, social workers, medical facilities, is often hindered by other inmates, sometimes by staff, by the shortage of staff, by a lack of professional staff, etc. And correctional staff as well must be sensitized to the risks that may be faced by children in detention, including the dynamics around sexual abuse. We're consistently surprised where we see correctional officers sometimes unaware of the sexual abuse that is taking place behind bars. And finally, strong connections should be built with outside NGOs, social workers, and other stakeholders who are able to provide some of the support structures that DCS is less capacitated to provide, counseling, and other forms of assistance. And the access of these role players to the inmates must be facilitated. That's where I'll end. Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much, Shasha. You see, it's a very good presentation because you are also coming up with recommendations. It's very good. You see, some of the NGOs are coming to the committee, coming and talk, but not coming up with recommendations, solutions to the problems. This will help us and the Department, Social Welfare, Justice, and everybody in. But thank you very much for the briefing. We will interact later and ask some questions on this. But I just want to find out with the members, is there any question of clarification immediately on this, or can we take the next presenter? Yes, no. Thank you very much. Let's go then immediately over to Department of Correctional Services for a presentation. Let me welcome the National Commissioner, Mr. Vinnie Peterson, to present to us. You can see, each and every person can see that the department is taking this issue of children very serious. That's why the National Commissioner is here with a senior member of the department, Mr. Damons. It's not a very simple thing, and they are really taking it serious because this thing is also having a very negative image, plays a very negative image on the Department of Correctional Service. Commissioner, you are welcome, and you can present.
Good morning, Honourable Chair, Mr. Bloom, Mr. Mawati, Mr. Salt. I have with me Mr. Damons, who is the Deputy Commissioner responsible for remand detention. You can see retention and detention very, very, very close. Ms. Shabalala is Director in the Office of the Commissioner. Mr. Jobadwana, you're more familiar with in the Minister's Office, constituting the DCS delegation. Indeed, Chairperson, I should confirm that we're taking it very seriously, the issue of children in conflict with the law broadly, and specifically children awaiting trial in correctional facilities. And the reason I'm taking it very seriously is that I'm sitting here after having been the Deputy National Director of NICRO, responsible for programs, who started the campaign around the issue of no child should be caged in the early 1990s. Subsequent to that, I was part of a team accessing resources from the United Nations to develop responses to children in the conflict with the law while I was the advisor to the Minister of Social Development. And now I'm at the tail end, Chairperson, as Commissioner for Correctional Services, where where I should be able to finally crack this thing, but it's still, I must confess, a very evasive issue. And that's why I thought, let me take time off and come and listen to the people who, some of whom fought in the defences with me around the battles to get children out of our system. And I think, happened to have been her boss in a previous life to announce his injustice, I can still give instructions. And Ms. Nkumalo from Social Development, I've been her boss as well. So I think things are beginning to fall into place. If we don't get it right with this kind of combination, I can assure you, we're never going to get it right, Chairperson. So I'm just by means of introduction saying that yes, indeed it is a very painful issue. You started by raising the issue of the 14-year-old whose name I shall not mention, currently taking us to court for the violation that he has endured while being admitted at 7 Westville as an awaiting trial detainee, and for some reason found his way into a hospital, which is of course totally out of bounds for awaiting trial detainees who are expected to use outside facilities. But be that as it may, allegations that emanated from there that has been brutally violated by an adult inmate, something that again pains me extremely, and as you've already articulated, something that we cannot tolerate if indeed it did happen. But these violations, and I think I'm glad finally to meet Shashi Ge, these violations happen within our facilities on a day-to-day basis. I've been quite aware of the work that the Centre for Study of Violence and Reconciliation has been doing around the specific issue of prisoner rape. And I've asked them, in fact, Chairperson, in June this month, we will have a roundtable discussion where we will unpack this issue of prisoner rape within our facilities and coming up with strategies to counter that. I'm a bit worried.
See, Commissioner Shasha, we are bringing people together. You see, the Commissioner is saying, finally, we meet Shasha again.
Yes.
Our comment, you see.
Chairperson, recently the Directors General of the Cluster visited KwaZulu-Natal and visited the Durban Westville Centre. We saw in excess of 200 young inmates awaiting trial, and I must confess we were quite angry when we not only discovered the large numbers but also that those working with these children were not too familiar with the circumstances and the issues and the facts relating to these children being kept in our facilities. I mean, you've also raised the question, for example, of the ages of these children. We found that the staff from Social Development working with them, they weren't even clear about the offences committed or the alleged offences committed. That's quite serious because, you know, depending on the nature of the offence, there's the basis for having a very strong argument for these kids not to be in our facilities in the first place. So if there's a lack of understanding of why they're there, it shows there's no rigour in terms of dealing with the issues of children in conflict with the law. Very, very worrying. In fact, the Ms. Batoy, who is the Deputy Director of Public Prosecutions, was quite perturbed by that fact when we asked the staff the number of children being held there for serious offences. We were told in the region of 20%. So why did we have all these children there? I'm saying, just again, that whilst we as social, as correctional services acknowledge that the issue of children, unsentenced children, is primarily the responsibility of the Department of Social Development, unfortunately, I think we cannot continue to separate the needs of children between the different functions that departments perform. We need to begin to acknowledge that as government and accept that responsibility. As government officials, no matter where we have a responsibility to serve the best interests of the child. And it's for that reason that I'm thinking, Chair, and you'll probably come and grapple with the issue of recommendation, that we need to be quite pragmatic in our approach. I mean, I'm saying since, certainly as government, since 1995, we've been trying to get children out of correctional facilities. And we're still exactly where we are. Children are no better off where they find themselves. If we are pragmatic, we have to make a distinction between what happens in terms of achieving that medium to long-term objective and how do we improve circumstances for children who do find themselves in our facilities. So it's for that reason that I'm quite keen to listen to the discussion and the recommendations that will come out here. But let me ask Mr. Daumans to give us a more specific overview, Chairman.
Thanks, Commissioner.
Chairperson, thanks, members of Parliament. The table of contents will address the specific matters that the portfolio committee requested the department to come and present, but also an overview of our statistical data that we thought is also relevant for the portfolio committee.
Sorry, Mr. Daumans, is the mics on? Can you hear? That's bad. Is it loud enough? Can you hear?
It's okay.
All right. Okay.
Thanks, Chair. So the background refer then specifically to the issues that the portfolio committee wanted to be briefed from. That's the available child-specific rehabilitation and reintegration programs, whether custodial staff have been trained to deal with specific needs of child ATDs and child offenders, the challenges DCS has experienced in accommodating the needs of child awaiting trial detainees and child sentenced offenders, and a breakdown of crimes children either waiting trial or sentence have committed, and whether programs have been developed in response to these specific categories of crimes. Now, the overview refer in brief to the children in conflict with the law. We are saying the average strength and numbers of children in conflict with the law can be summarized as follows. Between 9,000 and 13,000 children are arrested by the South African Police Service on a monthly basis. And approximately 4,500 to 5,000 of them, 50% of these cases, are converted into children's court inquiries in terms of the Child Act, and these cases are handled outside the criminal justice system. Now, Chairperson, this information is important from a South African police perspective, children that flow through the criminal justice system. And we are presenting that we all in the cluster work with the same baseline information when we refer to children issues. On average, 1,900 children are diverted from the mainstream criminal justice system on a monthly basis, and children acknowledge wrongdoing and the charges are withdrawn provisionally on condition that they attend diversion programs such as life skills, and if they don't, the trial goes ahead. And that's the number that stay within these is approximately 1,000 children in age group 14 to 17 years await trial on a monthly basis in these facilities, and usually for serious as well as violent crimes. Now, approximately 3,000 children waiting time detention, we find them in secure care facilities, places of safety, home-based supervision, run by the Department of Social Development. And 20% of the numbers of children originally arrested and charged are sentenced to non-custodial sanctions. And approximately 5% of sentenced children are sentenced to reformatory schools by the Education Department, and these facilities will be transferred to social development within the next 2 years in terms of Chapter 13 of the Children's Amendment Act, of 2007, and only about 1% of arrested children are sentenced to serve time in a correctional center. A worrying factor, however, is the placement of children without bail. That 87.7% was the figure in December 2007. Now we also have statistics on children in detention, sentenced children in the different age groups from 2003 to 2007, and I think Sasha alluded to that, there's a downward trend in terms of the different age groups and the figures that we are incarcerating. 895 children we hosted in our facilities by the end of 2007. Children in detention awaiting trial, also a downward trend. Sorry, for the past 5 years, we ended up last year with 1,166. Chief, this slide is also very important to look at. This number of centers accommodating the children, and correctly stated by Sasha that it sometimes happens that these children, they mix. So the different age groups that we work with within DCS is the children aged below 18 years, that's the first column. Then there's an age group 14, 15, 16, 17, and then there's a 18 to 25, that's now the juveniles and youth. And you can see the significant number there is 34,273 between age groups 18 to 25. So we want just to show a comparison between the children and the youth within our facilities. And that's quite a large figure, taking the DCS overcrowding into consideration. In the different regions, we have the centers, correctional centers, with the highest number of centers, children that's below 18. In Gauteng, we have Leeuwkop Juvenile Center with 116, KZN Ekuseni Youth Center with 80, Western Cape Brandfly with 74, Northern Cape Free State with Kroonstad 44, and Rustenburg 29, and Eastern Cape Craddock with 26. The total number of ACD children in custody, the same slide that apply to the centers offenders, there's below 18 with the different figures. We have 14, 15, 16, 17, and then the comparison 18 to 25, again a very large figure, 25,779 youth and juveniles we have in the age group 18 to 25. And then again the correctional center with the highest number of sentenced children in the country. We have Durban Juvenile Center with 237, Port Elizabeth with 113, Portsmouth with 76, Hoedtley Maxwell with 57, Pretoria Local with 45, and Nelspruit with 12. The next slide shows the different regions with centers and awaiting trial children in the different regions. Centers in Gauteng 171 with awaiting trials 90, Eastern Cape 96 with 292 awaiting trials, KZN 183 centers with children awaiting trials 312, Limpopo LMN 109 centers with children ACD 21, Northern Cape Free State 95 centers 116 awaiting trials, and there's the different figures with centers 816 and the waiting trial we have 1,048 by end of March 2008. We have also statistics children detention juvenile centers in the country as at 5th of May 2008. In Free State we have a Groenpunt juvenile center, there's only one sentenced child in that facility. Kroonstad, we have 44 centers, no awaiting trial detainees in that center. Boksburg, we have 9 centers, no ATDs. Simpson Yen, juvenile center in Gauteng, 42 centers, children, no ATDs. Leocorp Juvenile 110 with one awaiting child detained in that facility. Ekuseni Youth Center 86 with not awaiting child detainees. Durban Juvenile 42 sentenced and 222 awaiting child detainees. And we have 13 sentenced, 0 ATDs children, and Brunswick 72 with not ATDs. Drakensberg 17, that's in the different juvenile centers that we have around the country to show the centers and the waiting child detainees in those centers. Now, programs for sentenced children, and the research has shown also that there's a variety of programs that we are presenting to children sentenced within the DC facility. There's corrections programs with risk and needs assessment, census planning, structured programs, and one of the examples, life skills. There's development programs for census children, formal education, there's sports and recreation, as well as care programs in terms of social work, individual interviews, group sessions. The research work show exactly the different programs that were presented here to the committee. So psychological services as well as health services for the different centers of offenders. There's HIV/AIDS programs in terms of preventive care, support, treatment, access to antiretrovirals, spiritual services. So we are catering for the different needs of centers of offenders within the different facilities. Program for waiting trial detainees. The programs for this category of children falls with under Department of Social Development, the department is safe. And this is only provide the following services. Health services, crisis intervention by social workers and psychologists. So there's no structured programs for the awaiting child because of different reasons. The programs develop in response to specific crimes categories. That's the next slide. We thought that it will be interesting to show what are the top six crime categories of children. And in terms of the awaiting child, females, there's 17 under theft, housebreaking 8, assault 6, murder 4, robbery and drug related. That's the sequence and the priority of the six top six crimes. Males, top six crime categories, that's robbery, housebreaking, rape, theft, murder, as well as kidnapping. And for both genders, the highest priority is housebreaking, followed by robbery, theft, rape, murder, as well as assault. And we have also the top six crime categories for sentenced children. In terms of females, there's housebreaking, theft, assault, murder, robbery, capable homicide. For males, it's housebreaking, robbery, theft, rape, assault, and murder. And for both genders, housebreaking, robbery, theft, rape, assault, as well as murder. So that was the profile of the different children sentenced and awaiting trial up to the end of last year. Programs now developed for these specific crime categories. And we are saying as a department, the following programs have been designed to cater for the rehabilitation needs for offenders of all ages, including children. That's anger management, sexual offenses, a crossroads program, new beginnings manual and pre-release programs. Competencies, there's no ATD children are not subjected to specific programs. We don't have specific programs for awaiting child detainees. The research, as I said, also indicated that. Competencies of custodial staff dealing with children. We are saying personnel are trained, amongst others, in these different categories. Security, human rights, cultural diversity, financial management, communication, interpersonal relations, behavior management. But however, staff are not trained to deal specifically with the needs of children. Current developments to improve the management of children. The ISDCJ increases frequencies of meetings to share information and improve case flow. There are three subcommittees established to deal with children management. There's a children awaiting trial task team. There's a child justice information management committee. There's a child justice bill implementation plan committee. And the provincial child justice forum oversees children issues and is led by the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. The child justice bill is currently presented to Parliament for promulgation, and the bill require improved policy alignment within the JCPS departments and between JCPS and social class departments, improved processes of diversion, and introduces restorative justice measures for management of children in conflict with the law. Now, DCS has developed a monitoring tool to manage the following. Placement of awaiting trial children under correctional supervision in terms of Section 71 of the Criminal Procedure Act. Referral of sentenced children to places of safety, reformatory school facilities, and ensuring that children with bail option are diverted before entering a correctional center. Now, there are challenges for the system. On average, 87% of remand children are placed in these facilities without bail. There is no record of recognizable level of education as 98% of these children. And there's a lack of support systems for these children, 93% they are not visiting inside the facility. There's really serious crimes committed by these children. And there's a lack of capacity and expertise for the provision of services in correctional facilities for these children. And DCS is not allowing for the building of facilities for incarceration of children. And DCS maintains that correctional centers are not ideally suited for the rehabilitation of children. But however, those already in the facilities will be taken care of. The challenge in terms of ADD children is that some have committed serious crimes and could not be placed under correctional supervision. In terms of sentenced children, there are insufficient reformatory schools, places of safety, and therefore children are forced to be detained in correctional centers. And more reformatory schools, places of safety for children should be built. The department is cognizant of the fact that children below the age of 14 are in a crucial stage with regard to personal development, and imprisonment is not perceived as being conducive to the development of children in this age group. Chairperson, we would also like to make a few recommendations before we say thank you, given the challenges that's facing us. We are saying as a department, children waiting trial may stay in these facilities for not more than 2 years as an interim arrangement. And the Department of Social Development be responsible for services rendered for children awaiting trial. And then the Department of Social Development, in the meanwhile, build facilities to accommodate risk posed by all categories of children. And funding for facilities for the Department of Social Development then should be in effect. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dumont, Commissioner. Are you okay? We'll come back to questions for clarification and input on this presentation from the Department of Correctional Services. But thank you very much, Commissioner and Mr. Dumont, for this briefing. We will go straight into, because the other boss is looking for justice. That's why he called me out of a meeting, Mr. Yunus Karim, because he needs you there by 11. So the floor is yours, ma'am. Justice. You can hear that we are having serious problems in the correctional services, and you must really answer to this problem. Correctional service is sitting with a problem. Everybody is sitting with a problem, but it's fine. The floor is yours, ma'am.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair, and thank you for the indulgence. As I indicated to you, it wasn't a surprise meeting. The Justice Committee is trying very hard to process this bill, the Child Justice Bill, which has a great bearing on our deliberations today and will bring into effect, once it is passed through, a range of provisions that our current Criminal Procedure Act does not have. It will actually provide a very enabling environment for us. So that is really the urgency of the other meeting, in that we're trying to finalize it as quickly as we possibly can. And we're at a very crucial stage where the very discussions of today are what we're busy tweaking in terms of what provisions we put in the bill for effective implementation. And that is part of the urgency for that meeting, because we're hoping to finish. We're almost towards the end of the drafting that particular bill. May I also just introduce the team from the Department of Justice? It's myself, together with Ms. Fatima Khan, who is part of the Secretariat for the Intersectoral Committee on Child Justice, and I'm also with Ms. Swazi Taitai, who is our Parliamentary Liaison Officer. I also bring you apologies from our Director General, who also likes to attend these meetings, showing our commitment together as the head of the JCPS cluster, as well as our Justice Committee on Children, being located or convened by the Department of Justice. Having said that, Chair, I just want to premise, before we go into the entire presentation, the Intersectoral Committee on Child Justice, which I'm sure you know is an interdepartmental committee, which is chaired at our level of chief directors, and we report to the directors general in the development committee, rather, inside the department collectively, which then reports to the directors general cluster, which meets on a monthly basis. This committee is made up of each of the departments within the criminal justice sector. The intention of it, well, as you would know, came about some years ago, in 1995, and it was then chaired by the Department of Social Development, and it was then the Interministerial Committee on Children and Youth at Risk. The Commissioner mentioned some of the efforts at that time, which really was as a result of, before 94, the NGO efforts to get children out of detention, and of course when the new government came into power, this committee was then elevated to a cabinet level, cabinet decision, which put the committee, which was then chaired by the Minister of Social Development then, Minister Fraser Mulaketi at the time. Subsequently, the committee then changed because the Department of Justice then introduced the Child Justice Bill. And because of the overlap, in a sense, because people were attending two meetings, one dealing with the operations and one dealing with the deliberations on the Child Justice Bill, the committee, the convening of the committee then moved to the Department of Justice. And it's subsequently been chaired by that committee. This committee, and I'm giving you some of the background of it, because of the kind of work that has gone into it, and you heard from the previous presentation as well, some of the efforts that we've put in place, recognizing, and that is the main purpose of it, and I think that is something that we need to take into account very, as a backdrop, is that our criminal justice system has been fragmented by design. It was never nice. The Commissioner raised that. Children, when they walk into a police station or walk into a department, a courthouse, do not say, what is the Justice Department going to do for me today? Children are an entity. We need to respond to them holistically and comprehensively. Yet the way the system was organized in the criminal justice system in terms of our pieces of legislation has been very fragmented. And so the committee then is established to address the systemic fragmentation within the department, because you would also know that in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, each of our departments are individually accountable. And so what you don't have, which is a major problem that we face internally as government departments, is that each department will program and budget individually for its programs. And that does have an impact into the comprehensive system that you that in terms of service delivery. The committee then, in terms of the policy decision, as well as the entire JCPS cluster, has then been put in place so that we can address these issues and sharpshoot and target and intervene comprehensively and collectively, and also overcome the red tape sometimes that you would have, where the line functions can't manage it at the levels in front line, but we can manage it having to make the decisions necessary at the levels that we are at. And of course, where the challenges are posed, it then gets elevated to the DG's level for bigger policy decisions and so on and so on. In the way the committee, and it's one of the, probably the only one, and it stems, I think, to a large extent from our commitment to children's rights in the country, if you look at our constitution, and also the principles that we've espoused in terms of ratifying the Convention on the Rights of the Child, as well as all of the instruments that we deal with when it comes to children in trouble with the law, like the administration of juvenile justice, the Riyadh guidelines, etc. You will see that in terms of these principles, we've included non-governmental organizations together with civil society organs. So this committee meets as government departments on a monthly basis. We have been experimenting because that committee has been almost 10 years in the making in terms of its operations, even though it's moved between departments. So we meet on a monthly basis as government departments with the kind of officials who can make the necessary decisions, and then we meet subsequently with NGOs so that we can also monitor and benefit from their technical expertise and exchange of information. And of course, there are times when we also share heated discussions for the sake of movement of jurisprudence and intervening as appropriate. So it's one of the few committees of government where there is that inclusion. Some of the efforts of that committee is what the Deputy Commissioner has already raised earlier. We have several, having acknowledged, number one, that we have a major problem with information management. There's also a design by the previous government that there was no comprehensive tracking of children. So as an example, if a child walks through the police station, DSD will not be able to track that child because the number won't be child number X. When you move into the next system, your number changes. And then, of course, when you move into the justice system, your number changes. And when you get into DCS system, your number changes. So we can't track you as effectively as possible. And part of what this committee has been putting in place, and which we've done for a year now, is look at comprehensively how can we manage our information better, taking into account that we've been manually based. We can't automatically automate our systems. And we also have done that against the backdrop of the UN standards in terms of indicators for ourselves. We're hoping within the next 2-3 years we would have had a more effective system. But remember, it's part of the entire justice system, the integrated justice cluster, to improve our efficiency from an information management system. The other initiative of the ISCCJ has been a focused group, a task team, on awaiting trial children. Previously, we had the inspecting judge chairing that particular committee. At the moment, it's chaired by the Deputy Commissioner Damon, where we specifically look at children almost on a weekly, monthly basis, as rigorously as we can, not always sitting physically across each other, but telephonically as well, considering the flow of children awaiting trial. And we look at which children are in detention, what are their reasons. We have a policy where beyond 90 days, they cannot have a awaited trial without there being any possible intervention. And that is done collectively with the Legal Aid Board, DCS, Department of Justice, as well as Social Development. And you will find that if there are children in detention beyond the 90-day period, there are very specific reasons. And I must say what is commendable there is the inspecting judge, DCS, as well as Legal Aid Board responding as efficiently as possible to ensure that if a child is in detention for such a long period of time, that there are very serious reasons for why they have been there. Over and above that, having recognized as well that there have been some challenges with placement, we have now gone back to looking at those children who are currently awaiting trial and looking to reassess those children if they have been placed incorrectly. And one of the provisions that we've been using, even though it has been taking quite some time, from the reassessment, as it were, is the provision within the Correctional Services Act, though we haven't brought any applications yet, where if you've not been correctly placed, to take you back, because you've got, it's a court order, you've got to go back to court and have you replaced. So that's another initiative. And what I must say is, since 2002, we have reduced the figures by 50% of children awaiting trial in DCS facilities. That's a period of 2002 to 2007, because I don't have the latest statistics for this year, as it were. We've reduced the numbers of children awaiting trial in detention by 50%. And then, of course, the other task team of the Intersectoral Committee is looking at the implementation plan of the Child Justice Bill, which I'll go into some detail as I move through the presentation. So that's a backdrop, and there are two or three trends I'd just like to put as a further backdrop. The one is that, as I said, our constitutional framework requires us, as human rights are indivisible, interrelated, interdependent, and our constitutional framework espouses that principle, again as well within Section 28 of our Constitution. So what you will find is, with these committees and the policies together with the Child Justice Bill, which must be read with the Children's Act, because it gives you that comprehensive protection background, the principles and the programs that we're currently looking at to jointly program, because that's an assumption of the rights-based approach, is that we program jointly. And part of what we're dealing with in the implementation plan is, how do we collectively program to see the kind of benefits that we want to see? Because what we have found, which is for the last 10 years, as was mentioned earlier, is we're putting all these efforts, but we're not able to see the kind of impact. Because collectively, if you look at what budgets have been put into child justice, you're not seeing the kind of impact as you ought to see, because we're still programming quite separately. And that's something we're remedying within the Intersectoral Committee on Child Justice. Again, what has been gleaned from the trend is that, and the statistics that the Correctional Service presentation shows, is where the categories of offences are quite high, we're seeing high dysfunctionality amongst children, in high dysfunctionality in communities, in families. Because if you look at the offences, it's high aggression, coupled with sexual offences against children and committed by children, and to some extent socioeconomic crime, because those were the highest categories that the previous presentation showed. And trauma and health matters are coming through quite intensively, and we're finding that across the criminal justice system, especially as people progress through the court process. And that's a principle we've now included in the Child Justice Bill, because health, as you know, has been included in the criminal justice system for the first time in the Sexual Offences Amendment. And now the Child Justice Bill has also said, let's include this because of the trauma. And as you, through the assessments you will find, when children are assessed, you will find that there's an element of trauma, which does not necessarily mean, as we've had in the criminal justice system, that you need a committal to an institution. It means there are other behavioral and dysfunctionality in your own environment that needs to be managed. And that comes through in the sentencing trends, you know, mitigation of circumstances, and the assessment report. So it really requires for us to have a very comprehensive approach to addressing the rights and the needs of children, as opposed to putting them into detention. A phenomenon of our criminal justice system, or of our system in the country, has been use the courts as the first resort. And the position of the department is the courts have got to be the last resort. And because of the lack of services and the lack of policies and programs, which we haven't had and which the Children's Act now brings to the fore once it's implemented, because of the huge component of prevention and protection, we would be able to not use the court as the only resort. And that's been our response within the criminal justice system, not just for children, but to us as a society at large. So I wanted to put that as one of the challenges that we face within the criminal justice system, and the approaches that we have to have and the mindsets that we need to have to respond differently. And of course, I think, you know, it's a mindset is probably one of our biggest challenges in the country, not just from ourselves as department officials, but also from the general public and how we respond to crime. And that's one of the I wouldn't say concerns, but one of the issues that we have to tackle on intensively from a restorative justice perspective, because it's a new, I wouldn't say new phenomena, because traditionally in our societies we've had restorative justice as approach. If you look at our indigenous and our traditional systems, we've always had that approach. If I use the example of centuries ago, we were never detained in our communities. If you committed an offense, in the sense I'm using the punitive adversarial current language, but if you caused a harm to another community, there were no facilities to put you in. You remedied the harm between communities. So if you took someone's sheep, to use an example, you had to replace it with the sheep, as opposed to being put isolated from your community and put in an institution. Culturally, our societies didn't work that way. So it's a restorative justice approach that the new bill is centered upon. And in fact, it will be the first time ever in our history that we will legislate for it because of the oral tradition of our own societies. Now, if I may just go into the presentation at large and just look at some of the efforts that we've put from the Department of Justice perspective to address some of these phenomena. And the first one is, as Chair, you were raising, is the courts are putting, as you would know, the courts are independent structure, and they also would respond to the issues as they come before them. And so just to manage and provide more sensitization, because the mindset is really very important, is we've had to include restorative justice within the absence of a piece of legislation. Because if you look at our current Criminal Procedure Act, there is no concept, despite it having been amended on many occasions, there have been no amendments to restorative justice. The Child Justice Bill then creates this whole new dispensation for child justice and how we manage children comprehensively and bring in that restorative therapeutic approach from the criminal justice perspective. And we've done that in the absence of the bill through our Justice College, which trains our officials to include restorative justice in its curriculum. We've also got a child law manual, which the presiding officers as well as interpreters and personnel within the criminal justice system who are processed and trained in the Justice College have to undergo this as part of the generic training. In addition to that, from 2005, we've had different types of workshops where we've brought in experts and people from the non-governmental environment, including the NICRO and the other NGOs in the environment, to look to just run workshops on diversion, alternative sentences, and to, between this period, we've had about 380 magistrates in all of our 9 provinces having trained. We also have a bench book for magistrates so they can refer over and above the training manuals that they receive. The Lower Court Management Committee, which also sits on the committee ISCCJ, so that they can respond from a policy perspective as magistrates, have also published a circular to fast-track and prioritize children's cases. And the premise there, even though we do have our challenges, is that imprisonment will always be the last resort. In fact, that is a constitutional provision in any event. What the point I was raising about restorative justice, and I think NICRO has been the largest agency in our country, which provided diversion programs, and you will note it's only until the last 2 years that we've actually began documenting, from an information perspective, diversion programs. Diversion is not in the legislature. It's been a policy that the NPA has put into place, together with the service provider of NICRO. In fact, until DSD started providing services for diversion, it was not paid for by the state. And by international and practice standards of restorative justice, we know that they are better, it's always better placed for us to provide that service from outside of the state, even though the state would be the ones paying for the fund. So what you would have noticed then probably is a result of why our children in detention awaiting trial have reduced by 50% is that we've now got provision of services of diversion. So you will see the number of diversions have increased by 20% every year, which explains the decrease in the numbers of children awaiting trial. And the prosecutorial guidelines are very clear on how to manage diversion, and there are certain circumstances under which you would allow children to be diverted. I've spoken quite largely on the Children Awaiting Trial project. Over and above that, what you will find is that, and the Department of Social Development will speak to that as well, is part of their prescript, which is also policy of the National Prosecuting Authority, is that before every child, before the docket is processed to the next stage in the business process, there must have been an assessment. It's a prescript of the Social Development, the Probation Services Act, that every child on arrest must be assessed. And the policy of the National Prosecution Authority is, until there's an assessment report, I won't proceed with the docket. We do have those challenges, and that's where we normally call on, through the Child Justice Fora, which we have in each of the provinces, to pick up on whether this policy has been followed or not. And again, I say we do have major challenges in that regard. Over and above that, you will find that under the case review task team, which we have at the Department of Justice, that the directors of public prosecution always look, which is partly to do with the assessment, that the matters, especially for children, are processed as quickly as possible. Part of the Intersectoral Committee's policy, which is what we've come up collectively, is the time policy, and you can see there 3 to 6 months, 6 to 9 months, and 9 to 12 months. On an average, we have been able to manage that as a standard for ourselves, to have the matters processed as quickly as possible. And then if you look forward at some of the other statistics that I've put, only 28% of children await trial longer than 3 to 6 months, and it's usually for the most serious and violent crimes. And because of this continued focus, we are seeing, you do get the seasonal changes, but you have to measure trends year to year. And because we've not had the most effective management systems, we find it is a bit challenging to manage the trends. And so far, I must commend also the Department of Correctional Services. They have the most accurate of statistics because their systems are so much ahead of the rest of us. Some of the reasons for why children are awaiting trial, and this is a phenomenon that we're finding increasing, is that the numbers of children that are committing offences with adults. So adults, and we call that, the acronym we have is QBAC, children used by adults to commit crime. And we're finding that they are easier targets, so especially in the with the prevention and substance of substance abuse bill going through, something we've looked at very intensively as to how we manage children, not just from the a substance and abuse perspective, but also from the trafficking and the sex rings. And you can see also now, just from the new definitions under the Sexual Offences Amendment, the numbers of children that are used within the organized syndicated crimes and sexual crimes, because you're finding now an increase in the numbers of the offense of trafficking. Prior, we didn't have that as an offense, so you couldn't manage numbers and offenses through the criminal justice system. Of the two research projects that were conducted, 47% of children in those offenses were with adults. Offenses were committed with adults, and that has its own challenges. Also, we find with the children that are in detention, the rate of recidivism is incredibly high. And because we have not recorded diversion before, which we have started now, and the Child Justice Board proposes that we've got to keep this register to monitor if the programs are actually working, we're finding that the type of crimes are very serious and usually violent. Unfortunately, we also have a rise with children committing sexual offenses against other children, which is a very sad fact, but one that we have to take very seriously. And what we do find with the kind of programs, children are not recidivist, if there's such an English term, once they've gone through a program. So if they diverted, actually, you're managing the cause as opposed to dealing with the symptoms of the issue. And then, of course, I said dysfunctional families, the numbers of children who are in child and elderly headed households are on the increase, and that has its own life survival issues. And again, it impacts because at some point it manifests itself within the child justice system. An initiative by the department, I think these statistics and these phenomena have already been discussed by DCS, so I won't really go into that, but one of the limitations of the Criminal Procedure Act as it currently stands is the options for non-custodial programs. And you will know that our legislative framework does not allow us unlike with departments which have a provincial competency, does not allow us to have the kinds of programs at this stage from a non-custodial perspective. So as a test program we have now put in place, and we're still in the process of the design, it's almost complete, together with the other departments in 5 project sites, is non-custodial sanctions. Currently, we can put a non-custodial sanction, but it's usually a condition or postponed sentence. And through NICRO, in these 5 areas, we will then put, we've now put up this new system, and we'll monitor whether the numbers in those areas will actually decrease. And we've chosen the areas with the highest case flow. We have also a national protocol, interim protocol, which will become a final protocol once the bill is passed, as to how to manage, which I think, Chair, is the question you raised, as to placement from court to secure care. And that's somewhere where we as a system, not as one department, can manage. Because very often, and the reality is that you may not necessarily get the number of places in a secure care available on that day, filtering through the presiding officer. At the same time, a probation officer would say, but I did give the numbers to the particular presiding officer, but it wasn't necessarily used. And there would have been a range of criteria sometimes as to why you couldn't be placed in a secure care, either because if there's one that doesn't exist, or the child might be considered too much of a threat and the crime is quite serious, or they might have been charged with an adult for a very serious offense and wouldn't necessarily be able to be placed in a secure care facility. So it's a range of reasons, but we do have challenges there, and that's where we, as the interim national protocol, then assist and enable. I want to end, because I think I've discussed most of what the ISCCJ does, but I want to end on the Child Justice Bill and some of the recommendations perhaps that the committee may wish to consider, because with the Child Justice Bill, we're going to legislate now for restorative justice, which provides diversion. It also provides for non-custodial sanctions. And the one thing that it also provides, which I omitted in the presentation, is the one-stop centers, which is a holistic, comprehensive service. If you look at the statistics of DCS, which said in the Free State there are no children awaiting trial, what you will find in the Free State in Bloemfontein, in Mangaung, is the one-stop center, where you have a secure care facility located, and I'm not sure, Chair, if your committee has had the opportunity of ever visiting that center. That is now going to be legislated for, and we've got 2 of those centers in the country. They were test centers. You will find in the Mangaung one-stop center, managed by the Department of Social Development with a court and a secure care facility, you saw there were no children awaiting trial in the Free State because of that comprehensive service and everyone being located within the vicinity, so you minimize waiting for placement options because you know how many children. In fact, it's a walk across to the secure care facility, and that's one of the initiatives, I think, off the bill and how we manage that further. But what is also very important is that with this bill, you will have a comprehensive child development program, which previously we've responded as an adversarial system, an accusatorial system, to a large extent inquisitorial, which this bill now proposes, and will give us the teeth to implement some of the provisions that we're responding to in the absence of the legislation. But most importantly, what I wanted to say as a recommendation is we really need to look at the committee sitting jointly, perhaps, especially when addressing this as an issue, because we can't deal with it on our own. As we found in government departments, we've got to sit collectively. I would like to propose that the committees look at that, but also from an implementation of the bill. Because we've had a history in our country that you come up with a piece of legislation prior to having put an implementation plan in place, prior to having costed what is required, and prior to having the systems in place. So as soon as you get a bill promulgated, you almost have an empty paper right. And this is something I think we can remedy with the new bills coming through, and it's a cabinet decision that all bills must now be costed and implemented before cabinet actually adopts a particular bill or sends it forward. And this is one opportunity where we can look at that, and I would really like to urge from that perspective. Also, what we've put in the bill, which is new also to the Sexual Offences Amendment, is a monitoring and implementation framework, which previous bills haven't had. And that is where I think oversight is very, very important from a perspective of not just managing us as NGO, I mean as government officials, but looking towards the trends. Because as you would know, we can't always check every trend, and it's through the interaction that we actually improve our jurisprudence, we improve our trends, we improve our analysis. So those are two very important points. And then lastly, of course, is managing all of us to change the mindset to restorative justice. Because very often people consider it a soft approach. On the contrary, it's much harder to manage crime when you have to confront somebody, but also remedying the harm, which requires quite a lot of internal development and programs in place, and also changing our mindset from institutionalizing people as opposed to putting them in programs to remedy what the cause is, because we are dealing with children, and how we manage that both as government, both as committees, and the larger public to acknowledge this as a concept and not see it as a soft option will be one of our, I wouldn't say challenges, but something for us to look forward to. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you very much, Ms. Shahid. I hope that it's the correct pronouncement. Shahid, ne? Said. Sorry. Yeah, thanks. No, that was a very good presentation. No, you are correct to say that the committees, the portfolio committees, must work together. It is the correct approach. But you see, I am having a very good working relationship with a new chairperson. And that makes a difference also in a portfolio committee and the working in parliament here. Because I think that Mr. Karim understands, he's an activist. He understands that if there's a problem, we must come together to solve. It's for the first time that the two committees went to Portsmouth and to visit Portsmouth to check. We are crying and we are fighting that awaiting trials and overcrowding and justice. The portfolio committees don't understand what we are. And we said to them, let's go together. Now, the department, the portfolio committee on social welfare is our next target. We are going to take them to Portsmouth or any other place here before we arrive this time. I've already said to the chairperson of social welfare that we must go there. We must go. It's no use that we are screaming and talking. They must also understand and feel the pain. They must see what we are talking about. I fully agree with you. It must be a collective effort that we... But thank you very much. And I think that you can be excused, but are you coming back?
Chair, I've actually been SMSing, so I'll stay for... Because it's also part of the Intersectoral Committee on Child Justice. So
okay, you will indicate, you will indicate, but don't put me in trouble with your chairperson. Please, I'm very scared of Karim.
In the interest of...
Please, because he called me out of the meeting, he phoned me, and he said, what are you doing now? What are you doing? I said, no, man, it's not me, it's who has said she can stay. But, you will indicate to us when... you are free to go. Yeah.
You have leverage between each other. Imagine myself as an official of a department having
no,
to incur the wrath
no,
of the
see,
chair.
You have put
of
me
committee.
In trouble with him. And he has said to me, I don't want any excuse. I want her in my committee. And that's the I'm scared of him. I'm serious. I'm scared because he is a troublemaker. Mr. Karim is a serious troublemaker. A national working committee, of the Communist Party for that matter. Not only of the ANC but the Communist Party. And you can imagine what type of. But thank you very much. Let's go to social development. Are they here now?
Okay. Okay, now she has indicated that social development is not yet.
She doesn't know us. Even when she was talking to you, I was listening to her.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you. Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Connie Mumalo. I'm the Chief Director responsible for Families and Social Crime Prevention. I'm with my two colleagues, Mr. Stephen Masulefele. He's sitting right there. He's responsible for social crime prevention specifically, and also Mr. Mteto, who's also within that unit. I think the presentation that was done by DCS and Justice, so I won't repeat some of the things because we participate in the ICCJ, so most of the things are overlapping, but I'll try to make sure that I concentrate on specific responsibilities for social development. In terms of introduction, I thought it is important to indicate what the Child Justice Bill is requiring from social development. We said it poses important changes to the manner in which children in conflict with the law are managed and dealt with within the criminal justice system. Chair, since the conceptualization of this bill, the Department of Social Development has strived to align all its initiatives on children in conflict with the law to the requirements of the bill. The department is therefore responsible for the execution of the following functions stipulated by various legislation, including the Child Justice Bill itself: the provision of assessments of all arrested children by probation officers within 48 hours of arrest, provision and funding of diversion services, provision of alternatives for children awaiting trial, home-based supervision programs, provision of residential facilities, which are the secure care facilities. Also, the provision of pre-trial and pre-sentence reports, alternative sentencing options, prevention services and programs to strengthen existing capacity and opportunities for children. We also provide early intervention services to prevent children entering into criminal justice system. Chair, we also have a supporting legislation because since the bill is not yet law, but we are using the Probation Services Act as amended. Specifically, Section 4B of that Act states that any arrested child who has not been released shall be assessed by a probation officer as soon as reasonably possible, but before his or her first appearance in court in terms of Section 51C of the Criminal Procedure Act. Provided that if the child has not yet been assessed when brought before the court may authorize the extension of the period within which the assessment must take place by periods not exceeding 7 days at the time following his or her first court appearance. Section 4A refers to appointment of assistant probation officers and their duties. We also have a new act, the Children's Act, as amended, also had provision for prevention programs, also early intervention program. Specifically, Chapter 13, which was also cited by DCS, refers to the establishment of child and youth care. The measures that we have put in place to ensure that child offenders, I can't remember the heading now. Child offenders with criminal justice is limited. I think here there were questions that were put to the department, three of them specifically. So this is one of them that we're trying to address for the committee. What we do as a department is the assessment, as I've indicated, by probation officers. We do these assessments in courts, and we call those centers reception, assessment, and referral centers. When they give us an office within the court premises, we call that RAR. And then also in our DSD facilities. Sometimes such RARs are available in police stations. We also implement diversion programs. We also provide contact details to all South African Police Service police stations. What we also do, we visit police holding cells, because what we have realized is that SAPS is supposed to inform DCS of any arrested child, but it doesn't really happen that way. That is why you find some children slipping through the system. They are being handled through the court without any assessment report. So what we do, our assistant probation officers and our probation officers do visit police cells to check if there are children within the police cell. We also utilize the home-based supervision program as an awaiting trial option. We also participate in the turnaround strategy for children's cases, your case flow management through the ICCJ. I've mentioned about the secure care facilities. We also have plans to build additional secure care facilities. We also involve in advocacy programs, as I've indicated. And what we have also done, we are busy continuously building capacity for our probation officers. I've heard the National Commissioner complaining that in one of the facilities in Durban, our social workers were not informed or didn't have knowledge of even the type of offenses that the children have committed. In terms of human resources, I thought it's important for me to mention that because we do have approximately 479 probation officers countrywide, which are servicing currently 388 magisterial courts, 88 high courts, and 299 periodical courts. In terms of APOs that I've mentioned that they were introduced in our Probation Services Act, we do have also a program through the Umsombobu Youth Fund where we are training 220 young people as volunteer assistant probation officers. Ultimately, after the completion of that program, we are appointing them as APOs. But what was interesting was that even before the end of that program, some of them have already been appointed by the department. In terms of secure care capacity, I want to mention this, Chair, that we always hear that there's lack of secure care facilities, but I want to make aware this committee that our facilities are not fully utilized. As by the 23rd of May, we had 677 bed space available. We acknowledge that maybe the geographical spread of our facilities is not really conducive maybe for the placement, but I must record that there was no month where we had full capacity of all our facilities countrywide. The number of personnel per province, I've tried to summarize so that we can have a picture as to how many probation officers in each province and how many assistant probation officers. Northwest, we've got 18, Free State, 14, KZN, 41, Limpopo, 39, Gauteng, 75, Northern Cape, also 75, Mpumalanga, 18, Eastern Cape, 118, Western Cape, 54. Then it comes to a total of 479. Then the APOs are 296. What they do basically, they support the work of the probation officers in terms of administrative tasks, supervision programs, visiting of police cells and running supervision services in the home-based supervision program. In terms of secure care facilities, Chair, we've got 31 presently secure care facilities, and we are planning to build additional 22 facilities within the MTS. The challenge that the department is having is how many is too much, how many is enough in terms of secure care facilities. The same with prison. How many prisons are you going to build in the country? How many are you going to stop and say, this is enough? So what the plans that are there, what we have recognized, we've looked at the geographical spread and the hotspot areas in terms of the number of children that are coming into system. So that is why presently we've got 22. But we acknowledge that our colleagues from other government departments, and especially Justice and DCS, they are always saying there are lack of secure care facilities, but we are asking ourselves, how many is enough? If we look at the number of children which are committing crimes, the number of children which are diverted, the number of children which are released to the custody of their parents. On average, 1,005 to 1,008 new children are admitted at these facilities on a monthly basis to await trial. In total, the facilities, the 31 of them, have got 2,262 bed space or bed capacity. And at a given time, there's approximately bed space of 500. You can see for 23 May, we said 677. So on average, we have 500 bed space available for children to be placed. As I indicated, these facilities are always not fully utilized. The planned facilities will provide additional bed space of 1,320 in addition to that 2,262. And we need to be realistic and look at the number of children who really need to be placed in a secure care facility, and those that need to be diverted, and those that need to be placed in the custody of their parents, those that need to be placed in a home-based supervision program, and other alternatives, rather than really putting them in prison, police cells, and secure care facilities. What I've done also, Chair, is to give you breakdown of secure care facilities per province and the plans in which they want to expand. In Mpumalanga, for now, they only have one facility. What they've done, they've improved or increased the capacity. It used to be 35, now it's 60. And they are planning to build two secure care facilities in the other two districts, which is Enhlabeni and Gangala district. KwaZulu-Natal, you can see they've got quite a number, and what they are planning to do, they are planning seven secure care centers because the challenge is in terms of geographical spread. Gauteng, they only want to build one in Jabulani. Free State, they want to build one in Kwakwa. Eastern Cape, they are planning to build four secure care facilities in East London, Gumbu, Grahamstown, and Alwai North. Northwest, they want to build one in Rustenburg and one in Bupirim. Limpopo, they only have one presently, and they are planning to build two, one in Malamulele and one in Waterberg. Northern Cape, they are also planning to build two, in Namakwa and Pietersfontein. Western Cape also planning to build two. If you look at the numbers that they've got in Beaufort West and Worcester. Challenges experienced by DSD in accommodating these children in our facilities than in DSD facilities. I think the chair of the ICCJ mentioned the interim national protocol for the management of children awaiting care. What we have discovered is that there's no compliance with that protocol. The majority of arrested children are usually assessed in courts and in correctional facilities, of which they could have been assessed before even appearing in court and ultimately being detained in DCS facilities. That is why you find that some of the children who are in DCS facilities, honestly speaking, they are not assessed because this DSD was not aware of them, or where DSD was aware, they've been assessed and the magistrate didn't take the recommendation of the probation officer. The Criminal Procedure Act mandates staff to notify probation officers of all arrested children for assessment purposes and placement. The Interim National Protocol for the Management of Children Awaiting Trial further states that Justice and Constitutional Development has a responsibility to notify the probation officer of an arrested child due to appear before court and has not been assessed. Children are placed within DCS facilities through court order. They are not placed by DSD. They are placed through court order. Whatever you do as DSD, you can assess and make recommendations, but the final decision lies with the magistrate. So unless there's an argument that there are no enough secure care facilities, as I indicated, and that there are no enough probation officers to do assessment. But as far as we know as DSD, in most instances, they are not informed when children are arrested. DSD has dedicated personnel as required by the Probation Services Act. They might not be enough there, but we do have dedicated personnel to do the programs that I've listed there. And also in terms of diversion, approximately 19,631 children have been diverted during the last financial year. However, a more concerted effort is required to strengthen the program and fund NGOs who are providing these programs, as children are committing more violent crimes and sexual-related offenses. In conclusion, Chair, the Department acknowledges the intersectoral collaboration. However, if DSD is not informed of children arrested by SAP, such children won't be assessed within 48 hours of arrest, and they might end up in correctional facilities. If children are not assessed on arrest or within 48 hours of arrest, NPA should not proceed with a case without an assessment report. So that is one of the recommendations to say, if maybe we can say, if there's a docket that goes to NPA without an assessment report, they should not proceed. They'll just say, we cannot proceed without an assessment report, because an assessment report will begin to give alternatives in terms of placement for awaiting trial. Lastly, if all role players do not assume their responsibilities, it impacts negatively on the way children are dealt with, and some children fall through the cracks within the child justice system, and the departments start blaming one another. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Numalo. Straightforward. Very straightforward presentation. You see, we are going to have questions for clarifications on all the presentations. The Legal Aid Board will come in after the tea break. We will have tea break according to the program at 11:15 and so on. You will indicate when the tea is already sending. But I'm very much happy with what the Department of Social Welfare has presented to us, because we have always asked, personally myself, I visited Bloemfontein and Kroonstad correctional centers the other day. I don't like this word of centers, you know. I like the word prison, because it must be prison. Prison must be prison and not correctional center. There's some other centers that we can call correctional center, but not for now. But you see, we will come to. Let me give my members a chance to interact, Mr. Mahote. Is it not working? Press it again. Yes. All right. Presentation.
Some of the questions that I had overlap to the legacy board. I'm not sure if it goes to questions, but some of the questions have been
clarification questions. We will, as you can see the program. We are going into a discussion.
But I'm saying that when we interact with the presentation, some of the interactions that we have
you agree? No, that's fine. That's fine, Mr. Mahote. Then we go straight over to Legal Aid Board. Thanks, Mr. Mahote.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for the opportunity to come and present before your committee. My name is Brian Nair. I'm the National Operations Executive of the Legal Aid Board, based in Johannesburg. Together with me joining us at this presentation today is Ms. Cordelia Robertson. She is the regional head for the Western Cape and Northern Cape region. And helping us with the laptop in terms of the presentation is the head of our Cape Town Justice Center, Mr. Kubus Wustay. Our presentation slides were actually printed, and it's also appeared in before. The overview of the presentation today, Chairperson, we'd cover very quickly the Legal Aid Board vision, mission, values, mandate, and capacity issues, how do children qualify for legal aid. We'll focus specifically on children issues. We'll talk about how we represent children, how we monitor children awaiting trial in custody, how we approach the defense of children as lawyers in court, how we network with stakeholders. We'll talk a little bit about our statistics and then some of the challenges we currently experiencing. Chairperson, without going too much into detail, just to say that we see ourselves as playing a very constructive role in society in terms of the promotion of the Constitution, and we want to ensure that the provisions that are in the Constitution are promoted, respected, defended, protected, and fulfilled. And hence our vision is there. The mission of the Legal Aid Board is to be a leading provider of legal quality legal services. And we also have values that all of us in the organization actually subscribe to. Our mandate actually originates primarily from the Constitution, and we raise the issues of Section 35, 2 and 3, which includes Section 35, 2 includes all persons detained, including every sentenced prisoner, having the right to legal representation, and Section 35, 3, where every accused person has a right to a fair trial. Both those sections in the Constitution also includes children who are detained or accused persons. Section 28.1 specifically deals with children who have civil proceedings affecting them and the need for them to also have legal representation. The Legal Aid Act obviously is the one that actually gives effect to us, and we ensure that the objects of the boards to make available legal aid is realized in terms of the Act. There's also other legislation that provides for legal representation at state expense. Just to provide your committee chairperson with regards an overview of the Legal Aid Board's capacity, as at the end of the last financial year, the Legal Aid Board had four regions coordinating the nine provinces. Only one province, that's the Northwest, was shared between two regions, that's the Western Cape, Northern Cape region, and the
Cotonou region, comprising Gauteng and Northern Northwest.
You'd note, Chairperson, that we had 59 justice centres, 49 satellite offices, and 13 I Court units at the end of the financial year. Just for the sake of information, justice centres are basically our offices where we house in-house lawyers, and they also have an administration section to support them. So from there we have a coverage area of plus minus about 75 to 100 kilometer coverage area, and we link with the courts so that our lawyers directly travel to those courts and service them. Where the coverage area becomes a problem and we can't access the courts readily, our lawyers have to drive long distances, we open satellite offices so that they're closer to the courts that they are serving. It also creates access to the communities, especially those communities more rurally based, and they can access our offices where we have limited civil capacity to assist communities. The next slide talks about our staffing, Chairperson. As you can see, we are a growing organization. At the end of the financial year, we had budgeted posts, total 2,369 of them, of which 1,789 were legally qualified or legal staff. And we are pleased to state that our recruitment levels have been consistently high. At the end of the financial year, it was 93%. And notwithstanding the problems we have, especially with regards to alignment of salaries with other justice cluster stakeholders, we have been consistently dedicated to ensuring that recruitment levels are high. We also have other streams of delivery besides in-house lawyers, and that is through our Judicare system, where we contract with private lawyers who are present with us, who deliver the service on our behalf. And on a limited basis, we have cooperation partners in those areas where we do not have a a presence of our own lawyers, or we don't have the necessary specialist skills to assist us. The qualification for legal aid for children, you'd find that the Legal Aid Board offers legal assistance to all children in conflict with the law, and our normal provisions which limit legal aid especially to adults do not apply for children, and that includes the means test and the case type. So if a child is in conflict with the law and they are in requirement of legal assistance, we will offer legal assistance, and there would be no limitation to the price of legal assistance. With regard to focus on children, I thought the committee would require to know how do we focus. The Legal Aid Board recognizes that children represent the most vulnerable of all groups, and that special attention needs to be paid to the rights of children, particularly children who are in conflict with the law and those who are in custody. The Legal Aid Board has established children's units at justice centers linked to established stroke proposed one-stop child justice centers. These units are staffed by attorneys that specialize in the representation of children in both civil and criminal matters. Our practitioner per court model also enables us to ensure that we are able to represent children at any of the courts where they appear. Next slide, Chairperson, tells us more about where these children's units are located, with justice centers and the province. And where there's children units, it means we have got dedicated capacity of attorneys who specialize in children to represent them in both children, criminal and civil matters. How do we improve the representation of children? How do we ensure access? We have increased our staffing capacity at reception courts to 2 practitioners per court, so that there is always one person available to link with accused, including children, that are scheduled to appear at these courts. In this way, we are able to ensure representation for such accused even before the first appearance at court. This is an important strategy that we have implemented over the last year to ensure that we link and we try to provide representation even before the first appearance. And Chairperson, from the information we're getting, it's contributing quite favorably in reducing the number of underrepresented accused going through the court. Our practitioner per court model ensures that they are able to identify children who appear at the courtroom underrepresented. All our practitioners are specifically instructed to link with such underrepresented children, to explain the benefits of being legally represented, and to offer them legal aid. Our justice centers continuously monitor correctional centers within their coverage area to identify underrepresented children awaiting trial so that we can attend to their legal needs. This will include ensuring the earliest end to their incarceration. Additional paralegal capacity has been provided in this financial year to our justice centers that link with the 20% of prisons that house in excess of 80% of awaiting trial detainees. We are hopeful that this additional capacity will also contribute very favorably to reducing underrepresented accused, especially those awaiting trial. How do we monitor children awaiting trial in custody? All our justice centers are required to monitor children awaiting trial in correctional centers, places of safety linked to their justice centers. This includes visiting and interviewing children and offering them legal representation. Stats of our children held in custody obtained from both DCS and DST on a regular basis, and these are used by our justice centers as a tracking mechanism to ensure that all children are covered. We also work closely with the independent prison visitors from the Judicial Inspectorate of Prisons to facilitate access to children in custody and who are in need of legal representation. In fact, during the last financial year, we had a good project with them, which unfortunately came to an end. Justice centers also conduct their own regular visits to identify prisons to monitor all accused, especially children who are awaiting trial. And more recently, Chairperson, we have implemented a special web-based monitoring tool where we track all children awaiting trial at our justice centers. This web tool enables us to monitor children at an individual level, such that we identify the reasons for the delays in the finalization of matters, as well as interventions that our justice centers take to speed up these matters. In terms of our defense strategy, in all cases involving children, our practitioners are required to immediately make representations for the child to be diverted from the criminal justice system. In appropriate cases, the representations are made to the court for the charges against children to be withdrawn. Where the child is arrested for a minor offense, all efforts are made to use restorative justice options to resolve their matters. And where matters are likely to proceed to trial, practitioners are required to ensure that these accused children are released into the custody of their parents or guardians. Practitioners are also required to ensure thorough preparation for all matters proceeding on trial. All our practitioners are closely monitored by supervisory staff at justice centres. This includes holding case discussion forums where supervisors assess legal strategy for cases the practitioners have on their diary for that week or that day. Where children are found guilty of an offence by the court, our practitioners are required to, as best as possible, argue for a non-custodial sentence. Where courts find children guilty of offences, our practitioners are required to consider the option of noting an appeal and, if necessary, a petition to the higher court. In terms of training of our staff, all our practitioners recruited for these units have undergone intensive training in all facets of children's matters. The Legal Aid Board's training and development program also ensures that all practitioners attending to criminal courts are sufficiently skilled in trial advocacy with a specific focus on children's matters. Practitioners involved in children matters can also assess our SharePoint technology on our intranet, where they can interact with fellow LAB practitioners to obtain advice and support in their matters. And during the last year, we also entered into an agreement with the Centre for Child Law based at the University of Pretoria, in terms of which the Centre for Child Law provides training for LAB practitioners, as well as publishes an electronic newsletter to keep our staff updated on all issues relating to child law. We also provide personalized online support to any of our practitioners on children-related cases that they need support on. Networking, this was elaborated on by other presenters also. We recognize the importance of working together with all other stakeholders that are involved in children-related matters in the interest of forming a common understanding and developing common strategies for dealing efficiently with children's matters. And we therefore participate actively in the committees that have been set up. Both of them have been mentioned, including the ISCCJ, as well as the awaiting trial committee set up through that structure. Our justice centre is also required to participate in all structures at a local level to facilitate matters involving children, and specifically the case flow management at local level is something that we actually participate actively in. Our justice centre is also on continuous standby to accept any referrals of cases involving children from any stakeholder that refers them to us. Just a bit of our delivery stats for the last financial year when compared to the previous one. Chairperson, you'd notice that the number of matters we engaged in the last financial year, new matters we took on, was just under 400,000, and it represented a growth of about 10.4%. The growth is primarily at the justice centres, our in-house capacity, where we increased by 12%. There was small decreases through our other delivery streams. With regard to children's matters in the last financial year, you'd note that we provided representation to children in 42,000 matters. Most of them, 39,000 of them, were done through our in-house justice centres. 2,800 were done through outsourced private practitioners. For the information of committee, our stats reveal that the top 10 charges that children were faced with is not dissimilar to what was presented by other departments. Housebreaking, attempted housebreaking, constitutes by and large the highest 19% of cases of charges relate to that. Theft and attempt, 17%, and you can see assault and robbery, and the list goes on to the bottom. The challenges, Chairperson, in our representations of children, we have listed a few. The delays in the rollout of the one-stop child justice centres has negatively impacted on the efficient functioning of our children's units, which were set up specifically to link with these centres. To date, there's only two centres that are functioning, but I think another speaker has spoken about this earlier. Our current ratio of practitioners per court, especially at district courts, results in some courts not having practitioners available for all days during the week. Thus, children appearing in such courts may not receive immediate legal representation. this has been a problem that we have also shared with the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Constitutional Development, and we're hopeful that over time our capacity will be improved so that we can start to deliver the service, especially in terms of ensuring presence at all courts every day of the week. Our surveys also indicate that some children are reluctant to apply for legal representation as they may be interpreted as an admission of guilt. So there's a need for ongoing education programs to ensure that that children are aware of the benefits of legal representation. The lack of dedicated criminal courts for children's matters means that there is no single point within a magisterial district where our practitioners can access these children. This is especially in seats of courts where there's multiple criminal courts. We are hoping that over time the courts will dedicate one of those courts for children's matters so that more specialist attention could be focused on them. There is no early notification system to warn us as soon as children are taken into custody. This means that we cannot intervene at police station level to assist these children. The general lack of facilities for children in conflict with the law means that in some areas the children are held in facilities that are too far away from our justice centres, thereby making access difficult. The lack of child-friendly facilities also, such as separate holding areas and special consultation room, makes working with child accused quite difficult. There may be cases where the most appropriate sentence for an offender is referral to a reform school. However, the lack of reform schools means that our practitioners cannot even argue for the sentence option. Chairperson, the next slide you can ignore. It was a repeat of the others. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you very much for this briefing. It's 20 past 11. And I think that we are going to break now and then come back and then interrogate this all the presentations. And, you know, I am not going to restrict departments also to interact. We are here to find a solution, not to put anybody in a box, court of law here. We are here to find solutions to this problem, all of us together. But the members of the portfolio committee will ask some questions for clarification. You see, the legal aid board lawyer, the legal aid board will answer to a lot of questions. Because we are, the advantage of this portfolio committee is that we are visiting prisons. We are visiting. The National Commission is sick and is tired of us, our faces in all the 241 prisons. But we are doing it. So that's why we are well informed what is going on the ground and not here in Parliament. You can ask us anything about Parliament, we won't answer you. But ask us about what is going on in the prison, then we will answer you. But let's break for tea for 15 minutes, then we come back and then we will ask questions for clarification. Thank you. And to let's give him a chance to. Yes, now we are ready. Members, you will indicate to me by hand, showing of hand, and then we can interact with the department, with all three departments, and Shasha there, to ask questions for clarification, Mr. Self and Mr. Mahonte.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thanks to everyone who gave us the benefit of their wisdom. There are a couple of questions, and I'm just going to ask them all in one fell swoop, if I may, because they can be answered by more than one person. Yes. Firstly, there's reference made in several of the presentations to reform schools that I don't know where these reform schools are or how many of them or what capacity they have, unless they are contained in the definition of a secure care facility, but I don't think they are. The second question that I'd like to ask very pertinently, and I suppose it was in some senses addressed by the Legal Aid Board, but why are there children in prison while there are empty beds in the secure care facilities? I mean, it just seems to me, the normal excuse that's advanced is that there's no capacity, there's no space, there's no this, that, and the next thing, and yet we find facilities, I mean, we find people in prison and awaiting trial at that. Then there's some sort of rather more overarching questions. I mean, I'm obviously in favour of the provisions contained in the Child Justice Bill, and I think it'll go a long way towards solving on a systemic basis many of the problems that we're trying to address. But, you know, I think somebody made the point of you know, we have a tendency in Parliament to pass a bill and assume that the problem is resolved. Well, you know, I'm not sure, or I'd like to be reassured, put it that way, that of the practicality of all the provisions that are contained in the Child Justice Bill, so that when it is actually on the statute books, that we can then give effect to all these provisions. We've got the staff, we've got the facilities, got the systems, and that we're not going to find in 5 or 10 years' time that we go on a prison visit and we find exactly the same thing that we're finding at the moment. I saw just in passing a comment or one of the recommendations that was contained in the presentation by Sasha Geer, that it said, you know, one of the key recommendations of children in prison was keeping busy with education and development opportunities. Now, I mean, I don't know, Chair, if you recollect when we went to the women's facility in Polesmore, and we went there on a weekday morning, and the girls, young girls, were all sort of sitting around and in their cells and not doing very much. And they complained at that time that the educational services that they were getting were very patchy, to say the least. Now, again, it comes down to, you know, we have a requirement, both in terms of the South African Schools Act and in terms of the Correctional Services Act, that those children should have been receiving education. Well, I mean, it was clear to me that the education they were getting was patchy, to say the least. Then, finally, I was very interested on the statement that I think I heard being made, that people, that there are no such thing as recidivist children who have attended diversion programs. I'd just like to know whether we know what the success rate is of children who have been diverted out of the criminal justice system, put on a program, who then reoffend thereafter. Because I think it goes to the heart of whether these things are actually addressing the fundamental need that we are looking at. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mawate. And after Mr. Mawate, you
can respond to Mr. Thurs. Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I want to commend the presenters. Their inputs are very detailed, and they explain a lot of things. But firstly, I want to concur with Mr. Self. I also did not hear anything about the rate of recidivism from these sentenced children. The other question that I have, in fact, it's not a question, I was asked for assistance from the commissioner, because from the first presentation, on the background, there is a bullet there where the custodial staff have been trained to deal with the specific needs of children awaiting trial and the children offenders. Maybe the commissioner will help us there. The other one is, there was a mention that sometimes these children are mixed with adults. sometimes to and from court. How is that possible? How does it happen? About the juvenile centers, this thing, this has no pages. Statistics, children in detention continues as 5 May. I see all the other provinces here on this slide, but the Eastern Cape is not there. Yeah. I think, I don't know, on this one, this presentation. The Eastern Cape is not there, is it? Maybe because it does not have the children there. And also, programs, ATD children, all programs requirements fall under DFD. What are they doing about those children? Are there programs that the DFD is doing? Let me. I'm trying to do it fair presentation, sir.
You get another bite. Don't worry
anymore. Oh.
You get another bite.
Okay. On the CSVR, I think the commissioner also alluded to this question of, because the ages of respondents, they are only ages. I wanted to check about the offenses. What are the offenses? I'm asking this question, Chairperson, because we won't find a girl here in Paulson, a 14-year-old girl, for stealing school shoes. So what are the offenses of this? Let me stop there. I'll make follow-up.
I'll start by a comment.
Yes.
And be monitored, because you can clearly see that some things are not done properly. If you listen carefully to the presenters, that's the comment. Then on the DSC, we talk of these young people who are assisting probation officers. I just wanted to check who monitor these young people, and where do we get them from? Which structures do we get them from? Then on the very same DSD, I've seen one of the ones that is just near my place, where I grew up. But a place of safety. Is it still functioning? Yeah? Number of sexual care facilities. Is it still functioning? The reason why I'm asking this question is that I'm coming from the very same area, and there's no mention of that place being a place of safety, just like before. Thanks.
Thank you very much, in line with what Mr. Mahmoud said, you see, you must also, that is a program development and response to specific crimes committed by ETP children. You must also, the Department of Correction and to a certain extent, robbery, when it comes to robbery, can you please define robbery in the industry? Because you see, the different types of robbers. And the reason why I'm saying that, you visit children and you find that this child took a 10 rand from another child, and then he will be charged with a robber. The other person will have a time and drop that person. Different times, but all of them, or the two of them, will be charged with robbery. Can you please
You see, there is a robbery here, malicious damage to property. We have found many children in prison who is a proper suspect of robbery. And then when you ask, interview this child will say, no, I took a 10 rand from this, or 5 rand from this, and the parents open a case against me, and now, can you please define that? How do you come to that conclusion? Not you, but the police who have overseen you. Anyone who wants to take this
question?
Yes.
I can. Thank you, Chair. I'll deal specifically with the DSD questions for a start.
Yes.
The first one is that one of programs within DCS facilities for children awaiting trial. Honestly, social development is not providing any service there presently. But what we have done, we are working with DCS to start working on 5 prisons which are having more children who are awaiting trial, so that we implement programs there. We are just waiting for an approval from our DG so that we can implement those programs. Then if it's working very well, we'll roll out to all other facilities, because what we have got is a challenge of personnel, because what we're going to do in those 5 prisons is to appoint an NGO to assist us in running those services in DCS facilities.
Awaiting
trial. We're talking awaiting trial. Yes.
Yeah. How long are these children sitting there? If you want to, how long are these children?
That's another challenge, Chair, because in terms of awaiting trial, some of them, they say a week, 1 month, 6 months. So the structure of the programs, we made it a point that at least if a child is there, at least he or she gets something out of the program. Because it's not a formal education, because formal education is provided for by education. So it's more of your life skills and other programs that can be beneficial to the children who are awaiting trial. The second question was the collaboration, or was a comment, but it was a question on the APOs, the young people who are assisting probation officers. These young people were recruited through the newspaper, and they applied, and provinces recruited them. We involved the Youth Commission and the Umsobovu Youth Fund, and our department. We signed a contract with Umsobovu. They were funding, and also the department was also funding. The next one was the issue of places of safety. I think I need to clarify that not all places of safety are used to accommodate children awaiting trial. There are some that have been expanded, or because places of safety are for children who are offended through a children's court inquiry. So what we have decided as a department, we realize we've got shortage of bed space. Then we said, okay, let's look at some places of safety which we can use to portion and say these other rooms can be used to accommodate children awaiting trial. So you might find that the one that the Honourable Member is referring to is not part. That's why it's not listed. So what I've listed, it's only those that are accommodating also children awaiting trial. It's in there. Okay, I can check in terms of the functionality, because I don't understand whether the functionality means it's existing, but what I've indicated is facilities that are existing and functional.
So what you are saying to the community, you are having facilities for awaiting trial and sentenced children?
No, Chair. Places of safety, that's where you send a child in need of care through a children's court inquiry for a period of 6 months while you are looking for an alternative placement, either for adoption, to send to children's home, for other services. So what we have realized is that those facilities were not really fully utilized. So we identify some to say they can also be used as secure care facilities for children awaiting trial. So that's what it's not for sentence.
I said, Chairperson, that I'm going to ask my colleagues on Justice and Social Development to interact with our portfolio committee, since we do that all the time. And I'm sure you want to hear from them rather than from us.
Yes.
And I said, if I speak, the only time I will speak is to make their lives a bit more difficult and ask penetrating questions that you may not be asking. So I'm a bit hesitant to do that to them.
You know, let me, you are right. You think?
I don't understand why social development is saying that, and there's a list here of places, they are not fully utilized. Where does this problem, who is creating this problem? Why are we having children? There's 500, you are saying, there's 500 bed spaces. And we are having a lot of children in prison. Justice, the police, where does this problem come from? Why are we not having these children in these places of safety? The other thing, you must please explain to us. You are saying that in your presentation, mindset is the second page. Mindset. Why are people 14 years in democracy still treating children as if? Now you must help us. We don't know. Why are these magistrates and judges, and to a certain extent, legal aid board lawyers must also come in. The legal aid board must also come in here. Why are we still having this problem of children sitting there, and we are talking about mindset? There's policy in the country, and there's not a single one, including Dennis Bloom, who can decide otherwise. If policies are like that, it must be like that. Now, I really don't understand. Maybe you can help us. Yes, ma'am.
That is one of the issues of transformation, I think, that is hitting us as a country at large. A nice example of us having put together the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Discrimination Act, which deals with equality. And in a country like ours, which was built, the fundamentals of which was built on discrimination, you'll find if the equality courts are the least used in terms of our services, considering how much effort we've put into it. Now, I know I'm sort of answering a question with a question, but that will tell you, in a country like ours where there's been rife discrimination, and still we're not making as much use of these equality courts to address issues of discrimination, that will tell you the challenges of just changing over the mindset, not just from a race point of view, but from a gender, class, a range of issues. And the way the legislation has found itself to remedy this is to put, as we've done in the Sexual Offences Amendment, and we're trying to put it in the Child Justice Bill, is to come up with directives to departments to say, at least from the official point of view, to put in training programs like social context. And I have to say, one of the challenges we do find, especially within, I wouldn't just say judiciary, but government officials at large, because we provide the largest services, is just not only dealing with race issues, but also, in this case, child development issues. In sexual offences, it's gender-based issues. And then it cascades down, because one cannot ignore the deep-seated effects of apartheid. As much as we might wish to say 14 years later, why hasn't enough happened? It's something that we have to, in our ongoing daily lives, in whatever interaction that we undertake, we have to try and find ways to manage that. And I think that's part of how we have to transform society at large. There have been many attempts, and I have to say, ourselves as the department have run sessions on social context. And sometimes you walk through the passages and the way you're treated for the color of your skin or the behavior. I myself, as an official, find that when I walk into a lift, it's assumed that because I may not necessarily be of a certain skin color, that I could not be at the level that I am, or vice versa. There's an assumption. So those are things that if I have to face in my daily interactions with people, I can then understand people who may perhaps not have the kind of access to services and provisions I might have. So it's something that we have to do in our country. I mean, the recent attacks on xenophobia tell us something. The situation in Free State that happened a few months before still tell us that we have not resolved those problems. So as much as those are bigger generic issues, we face them as officials in the way we provide services. There have been attempts, but I think they have to be intensified. So you will find, as we were discussing over tea time, certain cases where certain types of children would go through a certain program and others won't. You get those pockets. We can only manage that, no matter what legislation we put in place. We can only manage that, as I think the honourable members were saying, from a monitoring and targeting each issue as they come along. Because we've got to be more vigilant as a society at large. When this happens, how do we deal with it? And I think it's a big problem of our country. We've normalized discrimination. We've normalized this subconscious behavior that, as an ordinary person, sometimes when somebody treats you in a way that is not dignified, it's not respectful, you almost don't notice it, and you can't even identify it's a discrimination, or you don't know how to seek the relief. We're just not a participatory democracy, as it were, sufficiently. So I know that's a very, perhaps, as our chair of the Justice Committee would say, esoteric philosophical answer, but we have to commence this too, if we understand that as a phenomena, and also understand the deep-seated effects of the trauma. We then can put in the programs in place. And for child justice, we are in the new bill to just respond to the implementation aspects, putting, and we're using the UN systems as well, because they've got the different and more advanced curriculum. So with their technical support, especially the Innocenti Center, to help us develop curriculum so that we look at not just child development, but the whole range of human rights training, so that we can then start internalizing some of the principles that our constitution has. Because it's one thing to have a legal framework, to change that is another. So that's in a generic way a response to that particular issue, because there are those problems. We have on our committee the Public Protector's Office, the Chapter 9 sit on our committee to help us identify targeted issues, because we know the generic forms of these problems, but where we can resolve them on a case-by-case basis, it becomes easier. It also then sets trends that certain behavior should not be acceptable in certain situations. So that is a way of us resolving it. The best is for all of us to be vigilant, and it doesn't stop as we try and then resolve it. So that is the one response. And some of the other more specific ones, and I'll go to the whole issue of the implementation. And what we have requested from the Portfolio Committee, and it would appear, and again I'm saying this because it's with the Portfolio Committee, it's ultimately their decision. We as departments, and most of us are sitting here, were there when we made the request, that give us an opportunity to put in place measures before you enact the bill is coming to effect on a particular date. We've requested, I think, as Justice Department, because of the one-stop centres at the time, we said to build a centre does not take 6 months. It's a long-winded bureaucratic process. It will take us some time. What we might wish to propose, what we propose and what the committee might wish to consider is for us to bring the bill into staggered implementation form so that the other provisions can come into effect whilst we build a center, as an example. So we have, and it seems like the trend would be, give us a period of a year before the bill comes into effect. But coupled with that, which is something we've never had in legislation before, minus the Sexual Offences Amendment, is a monitoring and evaluation framework where we've got to come to Parliament every so often and look at not just the policy but review the policy if it's not working, because previously we were stuck with a piece of legislation until it got amended so many years later. You couldn't change it, or you change it in terms of policy. But these policies, which is what we've put in to remedy some of the challenges and the question 14 years later, why are we still having a problem? So if 5 years later we find something's not working, how do we change it to see what is best in terms of service delivery? And that's part of what we're busy working towards. As soon as the final part of the bill is in place, we'll then do the costing of it so that we then know what we can and can't put in place. We will do, and that's what we've requested. We can't do, it's a transformation of a whole system. It may be 14 years in the making from our new democracy, but it's a long, deep-seated system that we've had, much longer than that. So we will put in place an incremental approach. We don't want to do a big bang, because some concepts are new, and we have to also test it in our own country. A lot has been tested, particularly through the Department of Social Development, the one-stop centers, and other, like the ISCCJ, those have been tested. So we're still grappling with some challenges there. So that's how we would, in terms of responses, manage the implementation. But a lot of it, like the training you've already started, the information management systems which the bill requires us to put in place, we've already commenced that. So we're not waiting for the bill to come into effect before we then start putting in place a whole lot of measures. So that's how we've resolved to deal with this particular bill, because it'll be one of the first few which has this M&E system and also has a more comprehensive cost and implementation plan. And we have put in a lot of efforts into this at the moment. We've been given a period of time to give a draft implementation plan to Parliament, so that that committee, so that they could see what measures have been put in place and how we're coping with those measures. With regard to the reform schools, I just want us to again look at, and sadly, we do not have the Department of Education here, because they form part of the criminal justice system, in that the reform schools have fallen under their mandate as a department. With the new Children's Act, the definition has now changed to child and youth care centers. So some of the points my colleague has raised about the places of safety, which deal with children in need of care and secure care and the range of options under that, including reform schools, would fall under the definition of child and youth care center, which includes a possibly residential program. And thus far they fell under the mandate of the Department of Education. There's a transitional provision in there, whereas Department of Education will still be responsible for the education component of the program, but they will not be housed as they currently are within their competency. That will move over to the Department of Social Development, and my colleague may wish to speak about that some more. They are only, with the ones that they were in the country, the way they were organized did not provide the kind of appropriate geographical spread. So there are actually three functional ones, and one of which is currently being renovated in the country. So you don't have reform schools, but My colleague, Ms. Mumalo, raised earlier, we must also be mindful of, when we put up facilities, do we want to institutionalize or do we want to have programs so that you're not located in a facility? And I think we have to be mindful that there will be those children who've been in the system long enough and may have to be in an institution, but then we must rather move towards, which is the restorative concept of having programs, so that you're not necessarily based in a facility. Because remember, if we've got a few facilities, when you have facilities, the principle is you've got to fill them up. So we also have to be mindful of that as to whether we're going to roll them out and how. And that's something the two departments are busy discussing as to what is the best option, as to how many more we will fill up. So
I hear that. I mean, I do really want to know where they are, these 3+1. Mm-hmm. But secondly, I mean, I hear what is being said about institutionalization. But I mean, on the other hand, the other side of the coin, you've got some serious maladapted, you know, sociopaths out there that happen to be 14 years old or 15 years old. Now, I mean, I'm, with the greatest respect, you know, I sign on, as I said, to the Child Justice Bill, but I don't want those people running around in the community with programs and not being properly looked after. So, I mean, there's a place for both.
Yes.
And I want to know, you know, what sort of, how many of these residential facilities are there? Because there's a need for them. There must be.
Yeah, there are. At the moment, as I said, there are. You have children who are quite, have been into the system and are quite seasoned, if one wants to call it, and it would depend. But it depend on what their particular needs are and what the offences are. And currently in the country there are four. And as I said, the child and youth care definition will now bring to the fore where the rollout needs to happen. I've just been hit with a bottle. So
Where is this form?
I'm going to defer that one to my colleague to respond because that falls within the Department of Education. I'll give you that detail before we've left this afternoon. I know there's one in the Serpentine Hendrina. I just need to get them in my head very quickly and then I will give them before we leave. If I could just move on to some of the other issues. I think there was a question on the recidivist rate. And what I said was, with respect to children committing sexual offences, you find that if they've gone through a program, whether it's a custodial sanction or not, when they've gone through a specific program to deal with the offending behaviour, the rate of recidivism is lessened. And that's very specific to children having committed sexual offences. And that's particular studies both locally and internationally that we have found. And that's very specific. Now, of the two or three studies, we've had them, NGOs have conducted them. We haven't as a state commissioned formal research. I'm not saying that's not formal, but as state research on recidivist trends. That's something that the ISCCJ is busy looking at. Remember, with our information management system and inability to track children, also from the diversion component, we don't have the kind of statistics to accurately and empirically tell you, here's the rate. Our experience tells us, from engaging with the NGO, people who provide the services, actually I've seen this child before. Or that program may not have worked. Or you might find through DCS statistics, children have come through the system. So we haven't had a process which is accurate enough for us to conclusively say, from an empiric scientific perspective, here's the trends of recidivism. It's purely our instinct and purely our experience that we busy, you know, we pull together and build on people's information as to what has happened. And we have now, having identified that, our commissioning studies, we're in the process of it, of commissioning studies on the rate of recidivism. So my point is very specific to the sexual offences where there has been research conducted. I agree with you wholeheartedly, which is why I was saying, from the perspective of committees collectively collaborating, that, and it's a question I think even the DG cluster has asked us, how do you work? In fact, the chair on the Portfolio Committee on Social Development was rather jokingly, which we took offense to in a joking sense, said, but how do your social clubs work? Because you as departments, you come together and you meet, and you all get on very well, which is the case, but systemically, how do you manage processes? And this is the challenge I was saying is, when we, and a colleague raised it earlier, when we come before all of the committees, we come with our departmental prescripts. And the way for us to address that, which is what the rights-based approach, which is what our constitution prescribes, and is an assumption of rights-based issues, is that we must program jointly, and we must program comprehensively. As soon as we don't budget together and we don't program jointly, we will always have departmental issues that we push forward. So when we come before you, and I think the Department of Correctional Services actually liaise with us as different departments in their budget vote to say what are your contributions from your sector into our budget vote. And if that happens more often, you would see then us in terms, because when we start having to organize our budgets, it's already decided at a certain level what the projections are for that particular period of time. In fact, for the Child Justice Bill, when it was first introduced to Parliament, the first time ever that there was a collective bid to Treasury was during that process where departments went collectively, because normally we go individually to Treasury and say, here's what we require to implement a particular bill. And that certainly is a trend we're proposing for the new Child Justice Bill, so that we don't just work as departments keeping our different mandates, but we work to jointly, to collectively program. On the issue of secure care, that's one of the, there was a point raised by the Legal Aid Board that we've not rolled out the one-stop child justice centers. It was a challenge. We only have two of the centers, and it was a specific decision made by our Director General
that I won't roll this out until the Child Justice Bill comes into effect, because there's a range of programming issues that are required. And I think they raise also the legal aid board that there's no facility for appropriate facilities to do reception, to do interviews, etc., which is what that particular center's prescripts are. And what we as a department said is, when we roll out, because the intention was to roll out 14 facilities, when we roll out, let's roll out in collaboration with the other departments. Because the way it was envisaged was a justice center, managed and headed by justice with the other services. And what we found now is we can't do it that way. It has to be done collectively. So where there's near a secure care facility, when we're deciding on where the next justice center would be, let's look at whatever services there are. So we minimize transporting by steps. We minimize people moving from one facility to the next. And we have a secure care nearby, we have the legal aid board, so that it brings the services, which is what the intention of the one-stop centers were, to centralize all of the services so they're comprehensive and more efficient. I think I have covered, sorry, there was a question of the definition of robbery, and the difference is with robbery there needs to be an element of force. And that's one of the challenges you have in terms of when a police officer, and you will find police officers sometimes providing or coming up with the charges. It's for the prosecutor then, who is usually the dominant leader, the person who then decides to take the matter forward, to determine if the offence is appropriate, and to ask the investigating officer, what is the information and the evidence that you have? And to remedy that, again, it's not an interim remedy, but the Child Justice Bill provides for a preliminary inquiry where you would determine, do you have enough information, do you have enough evidence, so that the child is assessed, and then it's determined if I have, because if I sold something for R100 and it's theft, I have a less, the sentence and the consequences are lesser, as opposed to if I stole R10 from you but I might have used force. So the consequences change completely, and that's what you probably find where it looks so incongruent. But the issue is, and my colleague said it earlier, the assessment process will unravel what is appropriate and what is not, and what would be the better option to respond to the offence or to the particular harm that was caused in that period of time. So I think I've covered most of the questions. If I haven't, we'll pick them up a bit later.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to add on the issue of child and youth care centers so that I give clarity in terms of how we're going to accommodate even sentenced children under 14 years, under the age of 14 years. We are presently working with education in terms of handover, but you'll remember that in terms of the criminal justice, we're only going to take over the reform schools from them. The School of Industry we're going to also take over, but you remember it's going through the Children's Court inquiry for you to refer a child to a School of Industry. What we are taking as a policy decision in the department is to say we really need to identify one facility in each province to accommodate sentenced children under the age of 14 years, so that we register that facility in terms of the Act, because the Children's Act also proposes that that center need to be registered so that it offers the programs that are suitable for children who are sentenced and also those that are waiting trial. The regulations also for the Children's Act are about to be published for comments, but they are also proposing that it is possible we can house children who are sentenced and those who are awaiting trial in one facility, provided that there is assurance of programs that they will get suitable programs, and there's also a security in that facility. So I'm trying to say we do have shortage of reform schools, but with a change, with a shift of child and youth care center concept, we will be able to, especially the under 14, to be accommodated in our facilities.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just on a more broader level, I think that we need to make distinctions between two things for me. The one is the distinction between dealing with children in conflict with the law broadly, on the one hand, and on the other hand, children awaiting trial. I think those are two very pertinent distinctions. in respect of children in conflict with the law, I'm a bit worried when I observe all this incrementalism. There's no framework, and I hope the Child Justice Bill indeed will provide that framework for us within which we will deliver a very comprehensive set of services to children in conflict with the law. More specifically, driven by a fairly, and I want to latch onto the point raised by the Honourable Taylor, driven by a centre where a department dedicated to enforcing that coordination. That's what I think is quite absent at the moment. I think in many jurisdictions we have dedicated probation services components, structured and organized. If you look at the number of probation offices that social services tells us are being deployed, I think it's quite negligent when you consider the need. So apart from the probation services, a dedicated probation service, overall being responsible for coordinating services on the basis of clearly developed norms and standards based on the Child Justice Bill, against which we will begin to monitor. I think when we talk about establishing such a coherent system, Chairperson, we have to be mindful of the fact that we're dealing here in the first instance with issues of rights of citizens, children as citizens who have rights in relation to issues of justice. And yet, when we think of the fragmented nature of how the service is delivered, we see some provincially based structures being responsible for services, and you get this kind of incoherence or lack of common standards. And I think within the context of rights, it's not something that goes down well. So I think I would certainly say that social development, if indeed it has to continue to play that role as the centre, which I'm not sure if they are doing or whether it's justice these days, that we begin to look at how do we enforce those kind of national norms and standards. So that on the one hand, I think that's part one of the debate, areas of debate, and that I can only hope that the Child Justice Bill will give us that kind of platform to come up with a service delivery framework. On the other hand, I'm saying that the other part of distinction is how to deal with children awaiting trial, and again, perhaps there are different departments again involved, but yeah, I would think that Cabinet recently requested correctional services to begin to look at the issue of remand detention. As far as I see the terms of reference, it doesn't make a distinction between remand detention for children and remand detention for adults. I think Cabinet is asking, can you lead an interdepartmental review of the remand detention system for South Africa? And therefore, I hope that under the leadership of DCS, we will begin to see how we come up with the issue of building that kind of remand detention system, including in addressing the concerns of children. And here, Chairperson, I just have to warn you not to confuse citizens, because we've just been through a very hard process of getting our act amended, talking about correctional centres and so on. And I see this official following your instruction and calling all these things prison. We've just been through a very painstaking process of amending our Correctional Services Act to ensure that we have correctional centres. No, I agree with you. We tend to generalise, and I do believe we should make the distinction of prisons and correctional centres, but not necessarily consistently refer to prisons. Within the context of remand detainees, I would suggest that we speak about remand detention centres rather than prisons. After all, they're still innocent Chairperson. But yes, I think the remand detention system and the review of that system is going to be quite pertinent, and we need to begin to engage on what the various departments are contributing and what ultimately the system is that we will see emerging. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Shasha, do we have anything?
Three are in the Western Cape, one in Mpumalanga. Two are envisaged to be built in the Eastern Cape. No, they're currently four. Three in the Western Cape, one in Mpumalanga. Okay, thank you. And if you need the further details of where exactly they're located, we'll forward that to you. Yes. Thank you. And thank you. No, I didn't. It was a mistake, I have to say. but the DG is just saying that it wasn't me, it was my colleague, so I'm deferring responsibility like a good official.
Yes, so you can't do
it. Okay, your indulgence is thanks. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks, Chairperson. maybe just as an aside, when I was putting the presentation together, and I got a colleague of mine to just make sure that it's okay, he insisted that I change the word prisons to correctional centers. And he said, I actually put the word prison. And they said, no, the correct.
You like the word prison?
I think it's more appropriate.
Okay.
Chairperson, I thought I should just respond to maybe one or two of the comments you made. Just highlighting one of the biggest problems that we experience as the Legal Aid Board, and that is the perception of the board. And we have shared this also with the other portfolio committees, etc. Because you get quite often statements being made with regards the Legal Aid Board lawyers double booking, running between courts, pleading guilty, not opposing postponement, and this whole string of things that one can say. And there was a time, Chairperson, when the Legal Aid Board was on the doom of collapse in the mid to late 1990s, when it was at that time being considered whether this entity should actually continue to function or not. And that's when we made this major change in terms of operational structure. And over the past 6 years, Chairperson, the organization has made a radical transformation from being an outsourced operation primarily to primarily an insourced, in-house model, where almost 90% of the services we deliver are delivered in-house. However, the negative perception that people had in the past still prevails to date, despite many of the attempts we make to actually change that. But we are encouraged on the basis that when one reviews the performance of the organization post the transformation efforts that is taking place, the organization can show quite clearly to all stakeholders, to portfolio committees, to the public, that enormous progress has been made. We're one of the few entities that can report 6 consecutive clean audits reports. Last 2 years, not even an emphasis of matter by the Auditor General. We can report continued growth rates in terms of number of clients accessed or provided representation. We monitor, for instance, our complaints that we receive, and the number of complaints we receive of an organization is so minimal, you cannot even count it. And any complaints that we receive, including when there's an oversight visit made by a portfolio committee where people, where clients or people in detention make some comments, but when we do the follow-up and we investigate those matters, we find that we're able to actually show an alternate scenario, including that the person could have already been represented, including the fact that whilst the person may have said they stole 10 rand, they could actually be in charge for very serious offences, etc. As an organization, most of our employees are very new employees in the sense they have only been with the organization for about 5 years. They're not carrying the baggages of the past. As an organization, we committed to ensuring that the people we recruit have got a passion for justice. They need to fit in the role of a public defender, whereby they understand the role that they play in the criminal justice system. What you were referring to, mindsets, is exactly what we actually try to identify in the recruitment and selection program. We have got an extensive organizational culture program that tries to instill this value, especially in terms of clients being indigent who are in need of care, and you don't just think that because they're not paying for the service, it's a second-rate service. So our lawyers must go beyond that call and actually make sure that the service that the client receives is consistently good. And therefore, our continuous quality monitoring and intervention programs to monitor that. So we're quite reassured that internally ourselves, we've got enough systems in place to monitor the quality, and that our generally, we're confident that most of our lawyers deliver the quality service. We need to note also, Chairperson, that in many of, especially in the prison where you've got sentenced prisoners in place, many of them could have been represented by the Legal Aid Board. And this is where it is. This is where the problem is. All of them have been sentenced. And if you ask any client who is in court facing charges, what is the role they want of the lawyer? It's not for them to get the fair trial, but to get acquitted. But the reality is that many of the people that we represent, you know, for them to appear in court already have a prima facie case against them. And we're not going to have success rates like how the prosecution is going to have. But our job is to ensure that they are given a fair trial, that their versions are put to court, and let the court make the decision. But unfortunately, when the result goes against them, then it's the lawyer that is actually blamed for it. So we'd like to assure the committee that as an organization, we put a lot of focus on ensuring that mindset that you were talking about, the passion for justice, to serve the indigent, the person who can't afford their own services, but our lawyers, you know, it's part of the way in which they provide the service, and the service is consistently good. So your concern is something that we continuously monitor to ensure that the mindset is right. So not only dealing with children, it's all accused persons that we need to ensure that we have got that passion for justice. And I can assure you that we are making very good progress. There was a recently, and maybe members of committee actually would have noted an article, a very negative article by a member of the magistracy regarding our services. And when we had the follow-up visit with the person, it was clear that the person was not aware of the new interventions over the last few years in terms of that. We actively participate in all local case flow meetings. We have got proactive attempts to work with stakeholders to ensure that the system as a whole becomes more efficient. And we're continuously on standby to respond to any issues. You know, we get quite a few referrals from the Minister's office, from even the Portfolio Committee, from the departments, and we're on standby to actually take it up. And we actually do it quite concertedly and diligently. Unfortunately, the perceptions in the past still comes back to haunt us. And maybe we need to spend more on communication. We're trying to do a lot of outreach programs in communities to share what we do with the in terms of providing access and representation. But over time, we're noticing a steady decrease in that perception, but it is still there. Thanks, Chair.
You know, I'm listening to you, Mr. Mayor. But you know, we this committee visited Portsmouth, I think in November. And it's the opposite in what you are saying now. I personally visited Grootvlei prison and Kroonstad and concentrating on children, not adults. And I called one of your people in Kroonstad, Mr. Grovier, he's managing the Kroonstad office. And I interacted with these children. And I asked them one by one, who is your lawyer? No, I don't. Who is representing you? I don't know. It's Legal Aid. Who is representing you? It's Legal Aid. What is the name? I don't know.
And the children, I'm saying, from 16, 14, 15. And it's serious. You know, we must not... adults is something else. Children, you know, each and every time when I'm on recess, I'm making it a point to visit the children section. And it's very serious to me and to the committee that we can't play with the future of children. I'm saying it's the opposite. Maybe when people are writing reports, they will write this type of things, this report. But to us, I'm saying we are on the ground. And members can tell you something else. But before you, Mr. Mawate, Mr. Dammans, also, and then you will get a chance. Mr. Dammans?
Chairperson, yes, I want to address specific questions that was raised by the honorable members. The bed capacity issue, why are there the 500? Within DCS, we have around averaging 1,000 awaiting trial detainees. Now, there's a process of reassessment while they are within DCS facilities. And then, after reassessment, social development, probationers take that application back to the court, the magistrate, to reconsider his initial decision. So that's one of the problems that they raise, that the magistrate don't consider sometimes.
It's on it.
So social development raised the issue that magistrates don't honor the recommendation from the probationer side. That's one of the issues. Then the other issue is the arrest period. While police are arresting these children, they don't report in time. So for the process of assessing the child, what should be done correctly there. So police is not represented here today, and it's difficult now behind their back to raise it. But in the presentation, they came out very clearly that people fall through the cracks. Then the other thing is the Child Justice Bill also debate the fundamental issue of the age group of children now. You know, we are not incarcerating people up to the age of 13 years. But the Justice Bill, the new bill, debate the issue of shouldn't it be lowered to 12 years and 10 years. I think there's also some of the arguments within that bill that the committee can take note of, the age group of who should be then continue through the process of the criminal procedure processes. Then the other issue is the different departments have different budgets, and there's no joint budgeting around children's issues. And that's also a serious matter, because we are referring to children fall through cracks. So there's no dedicated capacity within the different departments or a unit that manage specific children's issues. And that's one of the things that maybe budgeting can come up with a solution. Because even if you ask the question of recidivism, we don't have information on that. There's nobody that's taking care of recidivism and monitor and track these children as they go through the different systems. Then the issue of custodial staff not trained to deal specifically with the children's issues. Social development said they are busy with piloting different programs within 5 correctional facilities because our officials were trained to deal with offenders in general, including awaiting trial detainees. And as a department, and I think other departments also struggle with the issue of capacity. That's a fact, scarce resources. Even the Department of Education came up where they don't have teachers that can attend to the education programs of children incarcerated. So we should find some ways in dealing with that, and that's why we opted to request social development to assist with this process of education programs. The children who mix with adults, in terms of our act, that should not happen at all. That's a Correctional Service Act thing, and it's a non-compliance thing. We normally investigate the matters and deal with it in terms of that recommendations. So there's no other alternative. We have to deal with it as a department. We can't allow mixing of adults and children. The juvenile centers in Eastern Cape, we have a large group of children in Port Elizabeth as well as Craddock
in different units, but we don't have declared juvenile facilities in the Eastern Cape. And the two centers that I've just mentioned also incarcerate the biggest group in totals within the Eastern Cape. And then the issue of there's just robbery. When we admit any awaiting trial offender, there's no description on the warrant of what is this person being detained. Police, I'm not sure who's responsible for that. They just write on the warrant theft and robbery and housebreaking, but no description around that. I'm not sure what is the reason for that. But maybe there's a need, because sometimes people are just incarcerated for petty offenses, and we don't know that as a department. Jefferson, those are the specific references.
Actually, the important question that was thrown to us, Jefferson, which is the issue of the various programs and activities for children awaiting trial. And I think that is one of the issues that I hope this portfolio committee will confront directly. Currently, as it stands, the Department of Social Development theoretically provides these programs where children are in correctional facilities or in remand detention centers for children. Quite clearly, when you look at the various demands on the social development kind of area of work, I think it's an area that's fairly neglected. So on the one hand, you don't have programs, be that educational or social work or life skills programs for them. And I don't know how we're going to begin to address that. My own sense is that we need to get to a point where if we accept that we will be having these children in our facilities, it's not good enough to say let's continue to get them out. We need to, as I've said earlier on, we need to begin to address the fact that they are there. And I certainly would want to say that I don't mind social development entering into a service level agreement with me, where I begin to provide that facility and they pay for that against those norms and standards that they themselves would have set. But I'm saying someone must take responsibility. And either I take responsibility for directly and insist that Treasury gives us the money as correctional services for these people in our system, or we do so through social development. I mean, we need to set a standard of decency. It doesn't help me to have 200 children at Durban Westville, Chairperson, in one cell or two cells sharing one toilet, and they're not being adequate bedding, and the kind of I'm not even talking about training and development programs. We need to begin to set our standards of decency and begin to provide for that and monitor that. And so I'm really calling here publicly on social development to lead us in that regard. I think, Chairperson, it would have been good to have SAPS year, education year, and Treasury for that matter, so that they can begin to look at the issues of allocation. Thanks.
Thanks, Commissioner. Thank you very much. Mr. Martin, and then
Chairperson, I'm really not quite sure whether to continue with these questions, because the majority of responses that we have received are based on what is to happen, and are based on this bill. With that as it may, I think the presenter from Legal Aid Board mentioned something about perception. The other problem that we are having, Chairperson, is that we are going to this thing. Maybe some of them are getting reports, as you have just said. Because this thing is not a perception, it's what people there are saying. Even the IPVs that he has mentioned in his presentation are also complaining about the people there. Because when you ask them, they tell you, I only saw him in court. And he asked me to plead guilty. That's all. As a result, the majority of them, that's why here they are unrepresented. Because they say they don't want them. They rather they prefer to talk for themselves in court because they are asked to say they are guilty. So this is it's not a perception. It's something that is happening. As you correctly said, they don't know them. We go to prison and we speak to them, not what we are told that this is what they are saying. So for me, I think maybe if he has just said, in future they are going to correct it. But at the moment, it's not a perception. It's what is happening. So, and also a chairperson from the Department of Social Development. The presenter mentioned that they are visiting police stations. I serve in the Safety and Security Portfolio Committee. We've been to all the provinces. And in that committee, we've got a questionnaire that asks who has visited this police station in the past 12 months. Not one from last year up to the last visit that we had. Not one police station that we visited has been visited by social development. So I'm not quite sure whether these are the reports that they are given or it's what they've been to this place. Because we've visited more police stations, we've visited more prisons here, but as I said, I'm not sure whether to continue asking questions if I'm going to be referred again to the bill is going to do this, is going to do that. Because I hope that we are going to be told about what people are doing, about what is a problem right now. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Mawate. Anyone who wants to respond to what Mr. Mawate has said?
Thank you, Chair. Before I respond to the question of visiting police station, I just want to acknowledge and thank the National Commission for the proposal that he has made, because all along DCS was saying programs for children awaiting treatment in correctional facilities is DSD's responsibility, then they must see to provide. But if there's an alternative to say we can enter into a service level agreement and make sure that it goes, because the reality that children are there and they will always be referred there by the court, but what do we do? Because another issue is to render a service in another department's facility, it also becomes a challenge. But if they are prepared, as he is saying, to work with the DSD in terms of, we really welcome that. I will take it to my DG also so that there can be that interaction. And then in terms of visiting of police stations, I know for the fact, I'm not saying what the people have said is not right, but I'm quite sure that our APOs are visiting police first. The APOs are visiting on a daily basis to check if there are children who have been arrested the previous, and they do have statistics to say these are the number of children that we have found in police cells that were not reported to our probation officers for assessment. Maybe in those particular police stations they didn't visit, I'm not sure. But I know that it's a program that we have institutionalized. It's part of their duties to say you visit police stations to check if there are children who have been arrested and were not assessed or referred for assessment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Cordelia Robertson, Legal Aid Board. The Honourable Member earlier asked a question about why there are so many children in prison, why there are children in prison. If I remember correctly, in 2006, we were invited to attend on Baltimore with you, which we did. And I think the first lot of children we addressed was children under the age of 14, then children between the ages of 14 and 18, and then children between them, the ages of 18 and 21, and I think that was the biggest group. And you allowed me an opportunity to talk to all those groups of children. And what turned out that there was legal representation. They did know that there's about the legal aid board, and they were represented by the legal aid board. And I think there was someone who visited the women's section. There was a 14-year-old girl who'd been in custody, and I phoned you back the next day and told you this is what was happening. It was heartbreaking. It said she'd been charged with stealing 150,000 rand worth of goods from a variety of robbery, housebreakings and theft in Brackenfell. Then there was another incident. There was a child, also a girl, a waiting child. I think she was 16 years old. She had been charged with murder of two people who were living in the bush. And not only had she and a partner or a co-accused murdered the two people, they'd also burnt out, attempted to burn out their bodies, and that was a matter we were on record also once again in the High Court, and I phoned you back with all the information the next morning. So I think from my side, what is, when you talk about the children, why are the children currently being kept in prison? I think the MPA isn't here today. The magistracy is not here today. The SA police are not here today. Inspecting judge of prison, they are not here today either. And Department of Education is also not here on your form sheet. And I think when we attend our provincial stakeholders meeting in the Western Cape on a once a month on a Friday, the first Friday of every month, all the role players, including Department of Health, are there, and issues are discussed at the provincial level, so we know exactly what is actually happening. Also from the Legal Aid Board side, Department of Correctional Services in Cape Town, the chap by the name of Alvin Talia, on every Tuesday morning, I get a list of all children who are currently in custody. It says on that list, have the children been assessed, and 90% or 99% of the time the child has been assessed. Does the child have legal representation? Yes. And that is the information we are getting as a legal aid board from Department of Correctional Services. I think it's every Tuesday. Sometimes it's a bit late and it might come on a Wednesday. So all my justice centres, I get it. I then send it to all my justice centres in the Western Cape. And when any child is not represented, which has happened once or twice, then immediately a paralegal goes up, consults with the child, and gets the information and brings it back to the office. And then I think on the last point that I'd really like to make this point, that we were invited to attend on Hall North with you in 2006. Could you please invite us to your next visit to either Portsmore or Goodwood or whichever person you're going to visit. It gives us an opportunity to talk to people and to actually look at the allegations that are being made, that we are not consulting with them, they don't know who the legal aid lawyers are, that they're being charged perhaps for having stolen 10 rand, and it's actually a robbery where they hit the chap over the head. That sort of thing, it will give us a chance to probe that and give you back this information required. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Thank you very much, ma'am. We'll definitely organize such a visit with you. And Cindy will communicate before we rise on the 27th. We will organize such a visit so that we must, and in maybe include the Justice Committee as well. But we will definitely organize such a visit with you. I remember that you addressed that case of that girl who was an accused of two murders. In a car, it was a car involved. She burned they burned the two bodies in a car. I remember. It was 2006, no?
That's
yes, I remember. Yes. I remember that. You wrote a report. You sent a report to me, and follow it up even with the High Court and whatever and whatever. Yeah, we will organize with a committee such a visit, ma'am. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Much appreciated.
Yes, yeah. Commissioner, you wanted to say something?
Yes, Chairperson. Of course, I would like to say to my colleague from the Legal Aid Board, they're welcome any time to visit, even without the Portfolio Committee, both here in the Western Cape and elsewhere in the country. Chairperson, no, I'm just saying that it's useful that we're engaging with you and beginning to confront honestly what some of the challenges are. And I hear my colleague from Social Development saying that indeed there appears to be a shift in our way of thinking. I think from the start I've said that we need to be quite pragmatic. There's the present, as I think Mr. Mahoti is asking, and there's the future. And we've got to address how do we improve what it is that we have to deal with now. And I think it is a practical solution for us to engage with social development on the issue of the service delivery. So I think we can give that undertaking, that certainly from our discussion here, we will take that forward, Chairperson. So thanks to Social Development and to you as well for having created this opportunity for dialogue.
Thanks, Commissioner.
There was one question related to the findings of the survey that I just wanted to address. In terms of what the respondents had been convicted for. And if I may also just take this opportunity before that to draw attention to these two policy briefs which we've released at the Centre for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation, and which provide an overview of all the main findings of the study. So there's much more detail than those are available on our website, and I can also organise hard copies for the committee. And to bear in mind that the facility where we conducted the research was at that point a medium facility, and that still 42% were serving time for aggressive offences of either robbery, bank robbery, hijacking, or cash in transit heist. 34% of the youth were convictions for burglary or attempted burglary, 20% for theft or shoplifting, and 6% were for crimes of murder or attempted murder, while 5% were for sexual crimes. And they were medium sentences. The average sentence was 4 years and 6 months. That was the profile of these young boys who were interviewed. So thank you for that. And thank you again for the opportunity. It's certainly been very valuable to be here today.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Now, you know, I have said that we are taking this issue of children in prison very, very serious. The president of the country is taking it very serious. And I've said I'm sure all political parties, but I can't speak on behalf of them. But I know there's a resolution in the conference in December of the ANC to say that children, we must not. And I'm having the resolution here in front of me. But we must take this thing very, very serious. And I don't accept a statement or a comment by anybody to say that the mindset of people it will be a process of the changing of mindset of specifically of justice magistrates. It's not acceptable. We are dealing here with children and not adults. And I'm very much sure that nobody in the portfolio committee will accept that no, because of discrimination, because of it's a long seated thing that was planted. Discrimination. No, it must stop with immediate effect. It is not correct that we are making children victims of our mindset. Let's leave it out. Let's leave the mindset out. If you can deal with Dennis Bloom, I'm 55 years of age, but don't deal with a child of 10 years, a child of 13 years, a child of 14 years. Let us really address that. And leave this thing of things of the past out, because we are damaging, we are really doing serious damage to the future of the country, because these children are the future of the country. And you know, if we are not being very, very, very careful, we will have a society of criminals, because we are. A child is stealing. I met one in the Kroonstad, awaiting trial in the Kroonstad prison. there who was there for stealing chocolate without any bail. But you know, I don't understand that this child can't get bail. But very dangerous, serious suspects, criminals, are getting bail. This child is 14 years. I called the department. I called you, Commissioner. You were with the girl child, and you refer me to Mtseki. But even that, she was sitting. That girl was sitting for 2 years already, a suspect on murder. It's a very serious offense. A suspect. But you can't keep this girl for 2 years. Why are we not prioritizing these cases? I'm saying they are still suspects on this. It's not proven that they have committed this thing. When it comes to, and it's unfortunate, but I understand that justice is not here. But justice and the police must really prioritize cases where children are involved. Social welfare, thank you very much for understanding with the Department of Correctional Services. You see, our commissioner here is getting grayer and grayer by the day, because I know for a fact he don't want to see children inside. You see, Mr. Dammons was pitch black when he left the Free State. He was there in the Free State, but I can see his hair is white now because of these problems of children in prison. Members, please talk to the minister and the DG. Tell them that we are really serious. We don't want to see children in prison. We don't want to see them there. It's not correct for us to have any child in prison. And they must really do something. The commissioner has said that his door is open for you to negotiate and that, but that will come after. We don't want to see children. That is the full stop. That we don't want to see them. We understand some of them have committed very serious, like murder and what. But we must still have that open door to say that, yes, they are not adults. We must still treat them as children. And when they are above 18, then yes, we can then treat them as adults. But thank you very much to all the departments and the NGO. Shasha, thank you very much. We will call you now and then because you are also doing a very important and good work in our prisons. Members, thank you very much. We have organized some finger lunch. Everybody, Legal Aid Board, we are not fighting. We are concerned. We are very much concerned because we are visiting this, and we are getting this, but we will organize this visit because we are here. We are going to go to the prison there and give you chance, ma'am, to talk to them, and we will stand there and say, interview them, so that you must have first-hand information what these people are saying. But thank you very much, and thank you very much for everybody who is doing work. It shows that you are serious. That's why you are here to address the problem of children. Children are the future of this country. We must take it serious. When we are dealing with this hardened criminal, yes, I understand. I have said on Thursday, we must deal with them like a bulldog dealing with a piece of bone. We must deal with them. But not children. Children, we must say, let us find out what is the problem. Why is this children behaving like this? Our commissioner, in his past life, is a social worker by profession. He understands what I'm talking about. We are having children. All of us are having children. there's something very serious. But the magistrates, we must work on this magistrate. They can't bring all things into play. We are dealing with children. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much. There's lunch outside.